That's Five Finger Death Punch, the biggest song in rock. That does it for us this week. And if you missed any of the songs on the chart, all you got to do is go over to the SideshowCountdown.com and get caught up.
And download the free iHeartRadio app to listen to us 24/7, no matter where you are.
I'm Nikki Sixx.
I'm Carrie Kasem.
See ya.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead, stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
Now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much, and welcome to another edition of Night Call. Pleasure to be with you. Hi, Jolene.
Peter, good evening.
And we got some good things ahead.
Of course we do.
Tell folks at 11:30, one of our colleagues is going to be on the air with us, Steve Black. Looking forward to that.
We all know who that is. If you're from another part of the country or the world, you don't, but he is a DJ here at WRAF. He has a nationally syndicated couple of shows that he's that are quite successful and all rock related. He can tell us about that. But he's written an autobiography called From Black to Light. And I'm going to save the goodies for Steve to tell us, but I've started it and it is some really good stuff. It's wonderful and interesting and touching, and it's everything.
Sure, sure. Yeah. And one of the words in sort of the releases talks about triumph, which it really is too.
Sure.
We'll get into that a little later, about 11:30, when Steve Black from WRIF joins us. And you can go to his website, chopshopradio.com, if you want to get a little preview of at least what he does. This guy has intersected with every major rocker over the last 20 years. Yeah. I was astounded.
Yeah, he knows a few.
Yeah. All right. The bad news, I suppose, is all over the place, as usual. And the only thing that's good, I would say that the bright spot is Edward Snowden, the guy that leaked all the information about the National Security Agency's surveillance program, was granted 1 year asylum in Russia.
Putin said, you.
Yeah, to the U.S.
Yeah, he did.
To the U.S., indeed. And this is interesting, what's occurred. Let me see, I'm losing you. Isn't there a song about that? Anyway, I'll have to do it off the top of my head. As if you've been following the news, there's been all these alerts that Al-Qaeda is going to strike.
Yes.
And all these U.S. embassies are closed, and they've extended the closings of them. And I thought, I was wondering what the Republicans would say. You know, you're giving in to terrorists, because you can go to a lot of these African and North African countries, and there's no consulate, and there's no, there's no services from the embassy.
What do you think about the embassy part? I mean, we want all these bases closed, that's for sure, but...
Well, they just closed temporarily.
Yeah, but I mean, what about permanently? What would...
I don't know. I mean, well, I guess all countries need overseas expression for their citizens. Other countries certainly have that. You've been in Washington and seen, like, Embassy Row.
Oh, yeah.
That's quite incredible.
It sure is.
But isn't it coincidental, just at the point when people are beginning to challenge all these NSA spying programs that wind up to be extraordinarily invasive into all of our lives, they say that this is how they discovered that there was this threat by Al-Qaeda to our embassies and consulates. Mm-hmm. Through these programs that people are criticizing.
Or was it Ed Snowden? Is that how we found out? Did he leak it secretly?
No. The argument is that we need all this surveillance in order to protect us.
Yes.
And suddenly, just when it becomes under intense criticism, all these programs, and it turns out to be deeper and deeper and deeper and more invasive all the time, that we're told by the people in Washington that I sound like the president, the folks in Washington, which I want to talk about later, but that this actually forewarned us. Had we not had this NSA surveillance and spying and intrusiveness into our email and all of that, we might not have discovered that there was a threat from Al-Qaeda. Now, I don't want to talk about something that could happen in the future, but I guess I'm going to be very surprised if there is any attack on any of these consulates and what have you. Because the idea that somehow Edward Snowden, in leaking all this information about the extensiveness of the NSA surveillance programs, compromised U.S. security is so much HS. That's like BS, but from a horse.
Okay. I wasn't quite sure.
I just made that up.
That was a new one.
I just made that up, yeah.
I like it.
Because can you imagine anybody involved in any clandestine activity of any kind, from criminal activity to terrorism, going, well, maybe they're not listening. I mean, wouldn't they all assume that they're being listened to all the time?
Yeah, especially if they're up to something.
Yeah, and so I don't think Edward Snowden did any damage whatsoever.
Well, and that just it goes along. I don't know if you're ready to talk about Bradley Manning and the acquittal.
Well, wait a minute. We are, and I'll let you do that. But let me just say one more thing about all that. There's more. There's more NSA domestic spying now, and it's something called X Key Score. And this is new information about, and this came from Bradley Manning, from Edward Snowden, about the government's ability to intercept social network communications, email, metadata, and content.
Oh, yeah, this is amazing.
And other online, all without a judicial warrant. So the Fourth Amendment, which says there cannot be unreasonable search or seizure, suddenly becomes irrelevant.
Yep.
But Bradley Manning, yeah.
Bradley Manning, and this just happened in Fort Meade, that a military judge, it was Tuesday, found him not guilty. I couldn't believe he's been found not guilty of anything, first of all, just because of the way it is, right? Of not guilty of aiding the enemy, because that was one of the arguments for his release of those
They could have brought him the death penalty. Sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, exactly. And he faces 136 years in prison, but I don't know. Well, I'm wondering, do you have any guesses how long he's going to get?
Well, they're saying he's going to get a lot less. Maybe he'll only get 80.
Well, I know. That's what I was thinking. What does it mean, less?
Yeah. And again, there are people, in fact, very important people, that are advocating for Bradley Manning, the leaker, the guy that put all this information out to WikiLeaks, be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Because it really gave us an idea of so many shenanigans and actually war crimes, literally war crimes. And you can say that because some of the people involved were subsequently prosecuted for war crimes because their actions in Iraq were made public.
And on that note, that is one of the interviews coming up after 1 o'clock.
1 o'clock,
regarding Bradley Manning with Norman Solomon from the Institute for Public Accuracy.
Absolutely.
Great guy.
And there is one of the previous Nobel Peace laureates, a woman named McGuire. I can't think of her first name. She has formally nominated Bradley Manning for a Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's good. And by the way, it might be convenient if I told you that this is Night Call. I'm Peter Werby, Jillian Jordan here, as always, my partner in thought crime. And you can go to my website to see stuff, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. But maybe, in the 21st century, even Facebook.com/Night Call. If you'd like to email us, call talkyes@yahoo.com. But we are a phone-in talk show.
That's what we do.
Right. And you can call us at
313-298-WRIF. You can't be out of order. It doesn't feel right, Peter. It's off balance.
I know.
313-298-9743.
I wanted to repeat, by the way, the Obama and all of the people in power in Washington have their shorts in an uproar because Russia has granted Edward Snowden a one-year asylum in Moscow, in Russia itself. But Russia said that they request extradition of criminals and terrorists all the time from the United States, and the United States refuses to ever do that. And in Florida, you can find this whole host of ex-dictators and torturers and you know, military, people involved in coups and all that,
yeah,
that have been requested by other countries in Latin America. But these were our the United States buddies. I wouldn't say our buddies, but the United States buddies back in anywhere from the 60s through, the 2000s. And some of them are even mass murderers that the United States refuses to extradite back to, like, for instance, to Venezuela.
And there's that little thing like that.
Come on. Speaking of war, this is an easy piece of math to do, but I can't even get myself to do that one.
You.
We're coming up on August 6th, which is the anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima. And if, actually for the last couple of years, I haven't mentioned this because this is one of these,
Are you sure?
No, maybe I do it every year. But, the idea was that the United States had to use this catastrophic weapon first on, Hiroshima, then on Nagasaki in order to, end the war. Because if you think about this at all, I mean, it may depend on what generation you are. I don't know if you're 18 or 20, if you even have any sense of
what that was.
What it was, or other than it ended the war, which it certainly did. But
there's a lesson for you if you don't.
Yeah, the justification at the time was that the Japanese were so fanatically committed to the emperor and to not surrendering to the United States that they would have fought to the death, and that somehow the figure of a million American casualties were floated as what it would cost to invade and occupy Japan. There's no real basis for this whatsoever, and there was no military basis whatsoever for dropping this weapon on the Japanese cities.
You know what? And when has there ever been, Peter?
What, of dropping any bombs?
Any reason for any war?
Well, a lot of these bombings, the German bombing, the Blitz, so 1940 Blitz, here we're just talking about history earlier, right? The 1940 Blitz, I didn't realize this, I was just looking this up the other day. I'm just sitting around looking up the Blitz in 1940, and I had nothing else to do with my time. I didn't want to go outside because it was, 74 or something like that. No, the story's not worth that time. But anyway, there were like 40,000 English deaths because of this repeated bombing over quite a number of months. And it actually did nothing to the Brits other than give them more resolve. And the same thing, they actually called the British and the British press particularly called the RAF, the Royal Air Force bombing of Germany. They called it terror bombings.
Did they really?
Terror bombing on Hamburg successful one headline. And what they hoped,
and it was okay.
They were celebrating.
Terror was another. It meant another thing then.
I mean, the bombing of Dresden. I don't have the figures at hand, but the figures of the conventional bombing of Dresden, this non-military city, was comparable to the deaths at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Wow. If anybody's read or seen the movie Slaughterhouse 5-6, which is it? Do you know?
I don't know.
Okay, the Kurt Vonnegut book, and he was there. He was in Dresden, a prisoner of war, in a shelter. But a lot of people in the shelter, because they had this firebombing, they created these firestorms that just sucked the oxygen out.
So you know me in these movies. I can't do it. I mean,
But almost everybody involved at the time of the end of the World War II knew that the surrender of Japan was imminent. It was going to happen. And one of the things that the United States was fearful of, that they would, that Japan would surrender to the Soviet Union, who had just, give a whole history lecture, but was a possibility.
I like your lectures.
Okay. Well, I'm not, yeah. Okay. But, So Eisenhower didn't think so. Curtis LeMay, who said they could bomb the island into submission, the head of submarine warfare said they could just surround it, on and on and on. I mean, there would not have had to been the kind of invasion that would have caused any, particular casualties. I mean, some of the citizens were preparing for a U.S. invasion, which they thought was going to come with sharpened sticks. They had been defeated. The whole Japanese army was scattered
throughout. And here it comes, poof.
Yeah, like that.
I mean, the images that you see just in photography alone are just without reading about it.
Yeah. No, it's horrific. Horrendous. One of the things the United States wanted to do was to, well, here, people like Albert Einstein said that what, and a number of other atomic scientists said that what there should be is a non-military demonstration out in the Pacific to invite these Japanese military people, this General Tojo and others, representatives of the Japanese Empire, and say, look, this is what we got. You surrender tomorrow or we're going to use it. But the United States, according to the best historical interpretations I could see, thought, first off, that we wanted the world to see that the United States had it, particularly the Soviet Union, which was worried about it expanding after World War II, yeah. Which it did, and also that there was the willingness to use it.
Mm.
And in fact, at times, I mean, we don't see it like this anymore because the Soviet Union's gone, but they said it was the first shot of World War III. That's
oh
when the competition began. And so the hundreds of thousands of Japanese people were just incinerated.
It's
well, as usual, there are going to be numerous observances of this horrible deed across the world. And there's going to be one at the Royal Oak Public Library this Tuesday, August 6th at 7 p.m. There's a Japanese-American peace activist who was working in Tokyo when the atomic bombs were dropped in 1945, Motoko Kuthwaite. So it must be, the Kuthwaite must be the American part of it. Kevin Martin, Peace Action's executive director. And there's going to be lots of activity around the Royal Oak Library, and also you can park, I guess, in the library and farmer's market. So 68 years ago, that's what it was.
And I think it'll be pretty well attended. And Kevin Martin is Peace Action out of D.C.
Yeah.
You've probably seen him on television.
Yeah. And, you know, you've probably seen those things that look kind of goofy now. Duck and cover, kids getting under desks. Because during the 1950s, they would show kids silhouettes of Russian bombers. So if you saw Russian bombers coming over Detroit. Yeah, no.
Oh,
and, yeah. And when I was a kid, we would have air raid drills and go
down. Talk about fear in children.
Yeah.
Now tell me, what did you just say? You had what drills?
Air raid drills, where they would take everybody down, in all the students down into the basements. And then just for practice, they would turn off the lights. And then you'd hear all the little girls screaming because...
Because of you?
Not because of me. I would never do anything like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's going. Let me see if there is a...
I mean, that's coming, Peter. I think that's going to all come back.
Well...
And how did it feel when you had to do that? Do you remember at
well,
all?
Well, there were, kids had what was called nuke fear. They were, the odd idea that, the whole thing of fallout shelters and all of that. So, but the thing was that the United States... stood alone in its capacity to attack Russia until Russia developed the atomic bomb and the hydrogen bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And the Soviet Union, and this is now, through the release of all the Soviet era documents, that the Soviet Union never had any plans to attack the United States, never had any plans to attack Eastern Europe. On the other hand, the United States had all these contingency plans to attack and occupy the Soviet Union and the rest of Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
So.
Sounds about right, Peter.
There you
Sounds
go.
About as it goes.
All right. Let's take a couple calls.
Sure.
313-298-WRIF. Hi. You're on the air. It's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. I was just going to comment on what you were talking about with Japan surrendering. I don't know if a lot of people don't realize the reason Japan surrendered was had nothing to do with the A-bombs. We'd already dropped two on them. They were not going to surrender until they had confirmation that they could keep their emperor. And the only reason they did surrender was the same day we dropped the second A-bomb on them, Russia invaded Manchuria.
Right.
And they were afraid, more afraid of the Russians, because what did the Russians do to their emperor? to theirs are.
Right. Well, they thought they could do better. The United States had the biggest concern about the Soviet Union, as it said at either the Yalta or Potsdam conference, that they agreed to declare war on Japan as well. And that would have left, if it either would have been a joint surrender or a sole surrender to the Soviet Union, rather than just the United States alone being able to dictate the terms of peace. And then, you're right, finally guaranteeing that they would not disturb the institution of the emperor. But you know what? They were gone. You know, I think the United States had like maybe one or two more atom bombs, and they were all about using those if they had to.
Oh yeah, we had already done a ton of damage with regular conventional bombs on many of their cities already.
Oh, yeah. Tokyo. Curtis LeMay talks about leading these bombing runs, and these are civilian districts. These are not attacking, military installations or anything. About creating these again enormous firestorms. These are all war crimes of the highest magnitude. Both sides, all sides, were involved in just the most horrendous acts. I mean, millions and millions and millions and millions of people were killed in that war. And I forgot what the percentage is. It could be at least 75-80%, maybe more, were civilians. And in Tokyo, with all these homes that were in good part paper and these traditional Japanese homes, they just Curtis LeMay talked about creating these rings of fire that then just engulfed the whole city. And again, there may have been 100,000 people killed in Tokyo as well. And by the way, there wasn't a bit of sympathy. Yeah, they attacked Pearl Harbor. They killed 4,000 Americans there. The army acted bestially across and that's saying too much for the beasts. Beasts don't do that kind of
right.
What they did in China, what they did in other countries, how they treated American prisoners. A despicable army. And in fact, there was some of the generals were tried as war criminals as well. They should. All right. Thank you very much, Randy.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Let's see. Here is Lib. Lib is in Newberry. Lib, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello there. I lived in Japan for over 7 years.
Wow.
I've been to Hiroshima about 6 times.
Yeah.
And the better target was less than 50 miles away from downtown Hiroshima.
Because that was a civilian city, right?
Right. Hiroshima was mostly a civilian target. There was some military there, but it was like administrative people.
And there also, by the way, was a couple thousand American prisoners of war who died there.
Yes. I don't know if it was that high.
Okay, there was let's put it this way, since I'm going off the top of my head without this all in front of me.
Yeah.
There were American prisoners of war in Hiroshima that died in the atomic bombing.
Yeah.
As well as Nagasaki, but let me please get to my point.
Sure, go ahead, Lib.
Okay, there is a small island less than 50 miles away from downtown Hiroshima called Etojima. That is the home of the Imperial Japanese Naval Academy. That is where the study for the attack on Pearl Harbor happened.
Mm-hmm. That would have been at least sweet revenge, but it was weather that directed them to Hiroshima.
No, it was never a target. It was never on the target list.
Yeah. Well, they were there, the old Nola Gay, and what was the guy's name, Tibbetts?
Yeah,
yeah.
Tibbetts.
Well, yeah.
Who
the pilot? Let me ask you this: What brought you to Hiroshima? I mean, why were you the business?
I was in the American military.
Oh, okay, yeah,
yeah. I was. And also on Etojima, that small island, I've been there almost a dozen times, is now home to the largest above-ground ammunition dump in the world that is maintained by the U.S. military.
Huh. Yeah, there's still a big presence there.
Yeah.
All right, let me get another caller in before our break, and then we're going to be talking with Steve Black from the WRIF staff. Thank you, Lib. Thank you for that. Let's go to Kevin in Clinton. Kevin, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Welcome. How are you doing today?
Good. Thank you for welcoming me.
I've been up late.
It's okay. Me too. I'm just pulling with you. Go ahead.
I'm still trying to figure out if you were a liberal point or a conservative point when you were talking about the eavesdropping. I mean, are you for the eavesdropping or are you against?
Well, hey, how about this, Kevin? There has been across the board criticism on both sides. Both conservatives, people like Rand Paul, have been extraordinarily critical of the NSA spying, and as well as liberals on the left. And there's also been conservatives supporting this, and a lot of liberals like Dianne Feinstein, I think, who's chair of the Intelligence Committee, supporting it. So
But usually when it comes to us, it is, you can count on it pretty much being a liberal point of view.
Well, here too, but there is a Fourth Amendment. And one of the things, you know, in periods of crises, Lincoln suspending the writ of habeas corpus, or some of the horrible things that happened under the Wilson administration, the Roosevelt administration, certainly the Bush administration, in times like that, strict adherence to laws and the Constitution actually go by the wayside. But we're not in a period like that. We're not at war with Al Qaeda. There's not a war on terrorism. There are these right-wing religious fanatics who carry out criminal acts of mass murder and probably would like to do more. And it ought to be two ways. It ought to be contained, but it ought to be done within the confines of what makes this country, which means a Fourth Amendment, which says there should be no search and seizure without, reasonable cause, and that it has to have a warrant. So they're increasingly,
it's being stomped on.
Yeah. There's this, what do you think?
Absolutely. It's being stomped on at this point. I'm definitely in the Ron Paul camp, as far as, there should not be any deviation from our constitutional rights. I've said it before, I'll say it again, and I've taken a lot of heat for this. I would rather have another 911 than give up one of my constitutional rights.
Well, you know what?
Ooh.
Yeah,
I don't know about that one. You might want to put it just a little differently.
Yeah, I was going to say that probably. You say that among your friends or a night at the bar, and
maybe
people.
With your wife.
Yeah. In other words, Kevin. I understand what you're saying. You're trying to accentuate the strength of your belief in the importance of the constitutional guarantees. So that makes a lot of sense.
Right.
But we got to look at two things. Is first off, how can we legally and constitutionally protect ourselves? And secondly, how can we get to the root cause of this? If you're a supporter of Ron and Rand Paul, you know that they both advocate, and particularly the dad, getting rid of this interference in the activities of these other countries. I just saw this thing. We just took out somebody with a drone strike. What country was it? I think it was Yemen or something like, just the other day. And now they just said, oh, yeah, now they got a guy that's even more militant. So, yeah, so they killed one of the Al-Qaeda leaders, and you wind up with a guy that's worse. So it's not even working, that kind of stuff.
And there's always going to be more. It's not, not like where it ended.
Whenever we kill one of the bad guys over in another country, they just replace him with someone worse.
Well, they do, and it just...
Yeah.
Angers them more, and
it
creates more baby, as I used to call them, baby bin Ladens.
Yeah, it's like putting drug dealers in jail. The other drug dealers on the block or wherever go, hey, good, he got arrested. Now I can move up.
Yeah, here we are. We're in. That's my corner.
All right, Kevin, thank you very much. We'll continue to defend the Constitution. You do it, too. All right, coming up next, a conversation with Steve Black from the WRIF staff and his incredible book, From Black to Light, and what it touches on, life and death, rock and roll. I think you're going to get a...
It's good
a story.
Good stuff. We'll be enjoying it.
We'll be right back with Steve.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jolene will be taking more of your calls right after this. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The Weekend, brought to you in part by the Cash for Life Instant Games from the Michigan Lottery. You can turn an instant into a lifetime with Cash for Life Instant Games, only from the Michigan Lottery.
The Rip. Mike Rowe here. So I'm at a Ford dealer talking with customers about how taking care of your car is kind of like taking care of yourself. And I ask, which is in better shape, you or your car? Hint, the answer has four wheels.
Get the works. An oil change, tire rotation, and more for $39.95 or less minus a $10 mail-in rebate. That's $29.95. Click on the banner ad now. Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, and disposal fees extra. Rebate by check. See participating Ford dealer for exclusions and rebate details through 8/31/13.
My mum always says hard work never hurt anybody. Good advice as usual. So we worked very hard to make Geico.com very easy. Say you want to report a claim and follow its progress. You can do it all online at Geico.com. Not to mention perhaps saving a tidy sum of money on your car insurance. All it takes is a few clicks. So visit Geico.com today. Oh, and Mum, if you're listening, yes, I did wash behind my ears this morning.
Okay, everybody, so Jim's going to take us all through the company's plans for marketing, sales, and manufacturing before we break for lunch at Buffalo Wild Wings.
Growth.
Great presentation, Jim. Lunch, everybody.
Lunch at Buffalo Wild Wings. Amazing burgers, deliciously hot wings, and great sports. That's a lunch you can't wait to get to. Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports. Take your lunch into overtime with our bottomless, boneless lunch. Order all the boneless wings and fries you can eat. Weekdays now through August 30th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Dine in only at participating locations.
At Advance Auto Parts, summer heat can melt down your car battery faster than a snow cone on a hot dashboard. That's why at Advance, we test your battery for you. Free. Need a new one? We'll install it. Also free. No reason for you to get all hot and sweaty. Come to think of it, no reason to put a snow cone on your dashboard. But that's irrelevant. Fast, free battery installation only at Advance Auto Parts. Service is our best part.
Advance Auto Parts.
Most vehicles, most locations. See store for details.
101 WRIF. Locking in everything that rocks.
I'm gonna
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Well, thank you very much and welcome back. And a special guest in the studio with us, WRIF Steve Black. Hi, Steve.
Mike's not on.
All right, you were wrong.
All right.
Mike 3. There you go.
Now
one,
we know.
Two, three. All right.
And he's in the studio all the time, but he's over there where you are, Peter.
You know, it's funny. You know the outlines of people's lives and sometimes some details. And one of the things that I love about autobiographies and memoirs, you start filling it in, and sometimes you're just astounded. And besides all the work that Steve does with WRIF and
a nationally syndicated couple of programs, Chop Shop and
Classic Rock Live and The Core, and there's a classic rock version of the Chop Shop. So there's four shows total that I produce every week.
Jeez.
So, Steve, all of us, of course, meet the rock and roll greats from time to time at shows, and we get to get up on stage and say, Detroit, are you ready to rock? You know, that kind of silly stuff. But Steve has really interacted with tons of these folks, and there's a book that he's put together. It's a memoir, From Black to Light,
and it is available. And basically, when you open up the front inside, it says that it's a true life story of love, adventure, music, cancer, death, despair, tragedy, and triumph while interacting with rock and roll royalty. And as I've looked through the book, Steve, so far and started reading it, that's exactly what it is. And you have interacted with some people, and some rock stars that Peter and I don't really necessarily agree with, but you used to do radio with Ted Nugent.
Oh, sure.
We can talk about that.
You know, I was talking with Al Beck, who works at the station here earlier, because he was just asking about, you know, what must that have been like? And I said, I could do another book on that easy. The 2 years I did with Ted.
Did you ever get to talk?
Yeah.
Really?
I did.
You know what?
I did.
There was a little bit, something in here that might have thrown people back, and it refers, it's a play on your name. Of course, but From Black to Light, and we heard in that description, we heard cancer and we heard death. And tell us some about that, because in many ways, wasn't that really the motivation for the book?
Yeah, the opening paragraph doesn't hide. I mean, for people who don't know me well, or maybe didn't live in Detroit and knew Sabrina. Sabrina was my first wife,
and she was a DJ.
Worked here.
Yeah. She started at WRIF and then worked at many, many stations, but was best known for her years at 1130 AM, which was a sports station in town. And she was really one of the first female sportscasters on radio, because there wasn't all sports stations up until that time period in the early mid-90s. I guess it was mid-90s. But her struggle with cancer, the 6 years, really the last two, we started talking about what would life be like after she was gone. And that was when the idea came up where what she wanted was to write her own book, but she just never could find the strength, the time, the energy. So she started writing, bits and pieces, stuff for blogs, stuff in her diary, stuff that I don't believe was ever intended to be kept private. Mm-hmm. I think it was always, if there's a way to do this, please do it. And one of my last promises to her before she died was that I would find a way to publish that stuff.
And you found a way to do that in a really interesting way, sure, including your story. So it's just, I don't know, it just takes you all over the place, up and down and all around. I'm really enjoying what I'm reading so far.
And how
did you come up with the idea to mix it with your rock and roll?
Could I just interview?
I want that.
Question. That's a great one. But I just wanted, when you said the last 2 years, so the both of you knew she was going to lose the battle, right?
Yeah, I'd say it was about a year and a half for her before she really decided, like her last year and a half, she became aware that you know, it just wasn't going to work.
And how do you both live with that? I mean, knowing that if she found out that she had contracted cancer on your honeymoon, right?
On our way to be married.
Way to be married.
Yep. You live with it the same both ways. I mean, when she was ill, but we thought she would live, although honestly, it's one of the revelations in the book that I'd never talked about to anyone before until I put it in writing, was I actually just kind of knew it was revealed to me that she would not survive. So I knew from day one that she just wasn't going to make it. But she did not know that. She knew she was going to make it and just believed it wholeheartedly.
I guess we all did, too, because she had such such strength and spirit.
But you do live the same way when you know and when you don't know. You just embrace every moment. You find the happiness that you can in life, and you move forward.
Yeah.
You know, we used to talk about, you know, what was a good day. The good day was when we woke up together, and if we were both still alive to go to bed together that night, then that was a good day. Mm. And that was how we did, you know, played it out.
This is Night Call. We're talking with WRF Steve Black about his just published book, From Black to Light, and I rudely stepped on Jalene's question. Maybe pose it again.
I can't remember it.
What was it? How does this intersection with the illness and death of your first wife intersect with
how
this
did you sort that all
incredible
out in
rock story of intersecting with every great rocker of the last 20, 25 years?
The way you learn to do anything else through failure. I actually attempted a couple of different tries at writing a book about Sabrina's life because this was that promise that I made her.
Yes.
And it just didn't work. And I tried working with an author in Ohio, and we'd get 5-6 chapters in and you'd read it and I'd go, it's just not her. It just wasn't reflecting her.
Did it feel forced more than anything that you were forcing it?
And I just couldn't get, she was such a unique, lively person and I couldn't make her unique and lively. Until a doctor suggested, don't try to write her story, write your story. And then she will come out naturally because she was, you know, in those 4 or 5 chapters, she was the most important thing in those 4 or 5 chapters.
Yeah.
Not that she's a thing, but you know what I mean.
Exactly. And said, write one page a day or one hour a day, or what was that?
It was one page a day for 300 days and you'll be done. And that was basically what I did.
Oh.
That's amazing.
Just incredible.
So some of these rock and roll stories that go back, how far do you go back, just for the listening audience to know, in this rock and roll crazy world we live in?
I've been on radio for 24 years. So my very first gig was 1989. So that was about, that was the first interview I ever did. So that started the run. And I'm getting close to 1,000 now interviews.
What was your last one?
With musicians.
Yeah,
I was going to say it would take a long time. Even the list that's in the book here would take an incredible. And that's unusual. That this is through your show, Chop Shop Radio, right?
Yeah.
Because I interview people all the time. I haven't interviewed that many people.
I don't know, Peter. You might want to think about that one. I think Steve's got a little ways to go.
And, you know, the only thing, maybe push the answer to Jalene's question a little more. I mean, how does this intersect? You have this story, this tragic story, this romantic story, it ends in Sabrina's death. And yet there's, you know, you're interviewing George Clinton. How does that all merge?
It's just the way my life unfolded. I had this type of job that put me interacting with lots of rock stars. That was what I did. And, you know, I had to balance, how bad Sabrina got.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, well, it literally forced the action of me creating the Chop Shop. You know, which is also part of the book. At one point, she fell in the hospital, and the closed head injury was, I mean, that's probably the most difficult, well, one of the two most difficult chapters of the book for me to write was the day I was on the air at WRAF when the nurse called.
Isn't it amazing how you can do an air shift and still have that going on?
And said, you know, we just found your wife, and she's bleeding out of her ear. She's unconscious. We're rushing her into surgery. I'm like, she can't have brain surgery. She's going through all this stuff. And, you know, they're asking me to make life and death decisions while I'm here in a studio by myself over a phone. And I'm like, you know, so you're dealing with all that. And then at the same time, you know, 2 weeks later, you're interviewing Alice Cooper.
Yeah.
So when you write it, you just write it the same way because that's what happened. So it was just a matter of I said, if I'm going to do this book, I'm going to do it as real and honest as I can.
Yeah.
And that's the way the events played out. So I tried to be very open, which is weird for me because although I'm a public person, I'm really private. Most people
are private.
Most people come across as the The words I'm getting are surprised and shocked.
Hey, I've been to Steve Black's house. I've cooked for him and yeah. Talk about the not new, but you have a lovely wife.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm the most supportive person you could have ever dreamed of. And, you know, again, take a quote right from my book because I've spent all this time writing it, but it turned out to be the answer to Sabrina's repeated question of, you know, I can't die yet. Who's going to take care of Stevie when I'm gone?
The book we're talking about, written by WRF Steve Black, is From Black to Light, and it's the story of both tragedy and triumph. You know, that sounds corny, but you know, those words are in the English language to define what's there.
And that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. When you interviewed all of these rock stars and everybody we've heard of, like I said, I could just go through this list for probably the next 10 or 15 minutes. Were they aware of this? Were they aware of Sabrina and the cancer that she had and what you were going through?
I'm sure, as you know, there's situations where you've got literally 8 minutes with somebody and you can't get into that. But there are times after an interview where you get to, you know, talk about your life. And in certain cases, some of these people I actually have decent relationships or friendships with, and they all knew. One in particular that always stands out to me was Slash.
Oh, really?
I sat down with Slash, did this really wonderful interview, one of my favorites that I've ever done. It was like 25, 30 minutes in his hotel room or actually hotel lobby. And afterwards, he says, you got to come to the show. We're having this big birthday party for Duff afterwards and, you know, the big cake. And I said, well, my wife is sick and I've got to come. And I explained the whole situation. And he said, you know, immediately, manager come over, this guy come over, Steve and Sabrina are coming tonight. Take care of her like she is a queen. And, so some rock stars did know about it and immediately just, what can we do to help?
You also work a lot with the Trans-Siberian Orchestra. Sure. And it's a big fundraiser. Tell us about that. I mean, your organization.
They're a special group of people to begin with. They're amazing. But they give $1 from every ticket sold in every city they've ever played, in every concert they've ever played, to local charities.
Really?
Millions of dollars they have now given away. And when they're in Detroit, they give us 50 cents from each ticket.
Sabrina Black Foundation.
Which has dissolved and was...
It's moved on into another organization, right?
Now it's Gilda's Club.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So
that's very cool.
Well, what... You know, you said this book was for Sabrina, and some of it is her words and her thoughts. A lot of it is your life, Steve Black. But it's a book of general interest for sure. Anybody interested in rock and roll, anybody interested in, you know, the development of people in crisis situations and overcoming it. I don't know. Is there another book, or is this it? Are you just going to be rocking?
You know, I jokingly told people for years that when I retire from radio and I'm too old to do it, I'm just going to be an author.
Yeah, good.
And they're like, well, what are you going to write? I don't know. But now that I'm an author, yeah, I've got another 3 books in my mind. I've already diagrammed out one, but they're all fiction and science fiction and stuff I'm interested in. But this is, you know, we'll see how it goes.
Okay. This is an incredible book. It's
How do we get it?
350 plus. It's got the photographs alone of all the rock and rollers that Steve Black has intersected with are quite incredible. It's a beautifully designed book as well. And then, as usual, Jolene has cut to the chase. How does one pick up From Black to Light by Steve Black?
Easiest way right this second is WRIF.com.
Okay.
They put it right on the Riff website. It'll be there for at least a couple of weeks. And any time other than that, you can find it at my website, which is chopshopradio.com. And we'll see. We're most likely going to expand come like Christmas time and do the whole Amazon thing. I don't politically love everything about Amazon, but we'll see.
You're talking to the right show.
Yeah. We'll put a link on our Facebook page, too.
Awesome.
Which is facebook.com/nightcall. Well, Steve Black, I want to thank you so much both for the book, and you've honored Sabrina in the manner that that she requested, and I think
deserves.
And I think this is a book that is of interest to people that care about that kind of emotional. What? Give me a word.
connection.
Connection.
I guess.
Thank you.
And I often books like this, you know, there's the laughter, but some people this will heal by you writing it. And I know as a songwriter, that's what I always hope, and I know that's something that you probably hope for too, right?
Yeah, and I kind of wrote in the dedication in there for people who are going through cancer or have a loved one going through cancer, just to know that there's hope. And that's the main thing.
That's wonderful. Steve Black, thanks.
You bet.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Steve Black. See you in the hallways.
Yes, absolutely. All right. You ever read a newspaper and thought, I'd like to give that guy 600 lashes? Well, it happens, and I'll be back with that right after these.
You're listening to Nightfall with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Take me out to the ball game.
Take me out with the crowd.
I'm a designated driver. It's so darn cool. I will make sure that we follow the rules, so I'll pledge.
No beer, wine, or liquor.
And drive you home safely.
Because it's two tickets to a World Series game.
The reward for responsibility.
Team Coalition thanks you for being a designated driver. Visit RHIR.org.
101 WRIF.
We take these to the next level.
Oh, yeah. The Riff. The Riff.
Built to go, the Rock Run.
new home for Dave and Chuck the Freak is 101 The Riff. You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Well, right after this, what?
This what?
What?
What? After
well,
what?
Al Beck, he rarely slips on the job.
Yeah, Al Beck was our all-night, overnight DJ, and that what is called in the trade of production. And so that's supposed to take you into commercials.
I went, hey, why not?
What the hey? Yeah, so it's anyways, 313... whatever it is.
313-298-9743. Yeah. Open lines. It was great to talk to Steve Black. That was a wonderful
interview. Yeah, WRIF staffer who's written this book about rock and roll, but also around the illness and death of his first wife.
Yeah.
Very moving. Very moving.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah. Anyway, I was mentioning before the break that think about when you read a newspaper or when you hear somebody on the radio. So that would be me and Jolene for some of you about, I wish I could have, you know, like that.
Sure.
Well, here's what they do in Saudi Arabia. The founder of a liberal website in Saudi Arabia has been sentenced to 7 years in prison and 600 lashes after angering Islamic authorities in Saudi Arabia. The newspaper Al Watan reported on Tuesday. The site created by Raif Badawi urged Saudis to share opinions about the role of religion in the country, which follows a strict form of Islam. According to the newspaper Al Watan, a judge in the Red Sea port of Jeddah imposed the sentences but dropped charges of heresy, which could have brought a death sentence.
Peter, when I read that, I gasped, first of all. Not that it's a big shocker that that kind of thing goes on, but here you and I are in the studio for all these years and encouraging people to give us opinions about whatever, religion, abortion, gay marriage, the environment, you name it. We are so free. I read that, and I mean, I know we are, but I thought, man.
Well, here's what this guy did. Let me just say it again.
We would be dead over there.
He urged Saudis to share opinions about the role of religion.
That's it.
Share opinions.
Share opinions about the role of religion.
Wow.
And we ask you people to do that every week.
So this is one of our grand allies, right?
Our buddies, right?
Our buddies over there. And what we send them military equipment. They send us 9/11 bombers.
Yes.
Right?
See?
That's fair.
See?
That's fair.
But we don't bomb them. We bomb another country instead.
Yep.
Ah.
All right, let's go back to our phones. We've been talking about any number of things. The Bradley Manning conviction, he is the young PFC who released hundreds of thousands of military and diplomatic documents to WikiLeaks and have been published. And also about Edward Snowden, who has gotten 1 year's asylum in Russia. And I think both these guys did incredible service to the Constitution. And no, absolutely no government likes its secrets out. And some people have said, and you ought to weigh in on this at 313-298-WRIF, how many secrets should a country have? And what level should this information be held from the public in order to make decisions? We got to decide what we want to do. And what causes the need for us to have that kind of so-called security? And does it actually provide security? I doubt it.
Where's the proof?
Well, the proof now, apparently, has been said that there is this imminent threat from Al-Qaeda to attack our consulates and our embassies across the world. A number of them have been shut down. Some people are saying, hey, we're giving in to terrorism. Other people say, we don't want another Benghazi. But it was said by Senator Dianne Feinstein. Or some of these folks were saying, this is proof why we need these surveillance systems, because we were tipped off that this was going on. They say it's chatter on the internet. And it's like I imagine, the people thinking them speaking in Arabic, like that. They're getting crazed, or something like that. I mean, that's nonsense.
Yeah. And
that's absolute nonsense.
They were going to come out no matter what and say that to cover their asses, Peter.
So I wonder how much of this is actually accurate. But is the conspiracy that overt that somebody somewhere in the Pentagon or in the White House or wherever would say, I got an idea. Let's make up that Al-Qaeda is going to attack us. Yeah, okay.
you know. You go.
That's a simple answer. All right, let's get Lee on. Lee from Southfield on the air. Lee, hi, it's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us. You're on the air.
Well, hi, Peter and Jalene. This is Lee. I'm calling from Southfield.
Oh.
I'm an ex-Army Ranger from 26 years ago.
Hi, Lee.
Living with the 1st Infantry Division, the Big Red One.
Oh, yeah.
I've lived here in Michigan all my life, Detroit, suburbia. Been a big fan of WRIF for many, many years.
Wonderful.
And this is one of the closest things I can, I've touched on many, many topics having been out of the Army since 1987. And back in the day, well, us guys, we used to have, you remember the illustrious Omar Gaddafi of Libya. We used to have posters on our wall lockers throwing darts at him.
Really?
And, we get various things coming down through the State Department, where we were on 16 different standby alerts out there at Fort Riley, Kansas, and to head on over to take care of situations over in the Middle East. But then we were stood down, and other outfits were going in our place, either to assess the situation with military field observers over in the region. And, little things like that. And then they would get redirected to another party going down from the Middle East down to a little party called Somalia, where our Army Rangers were dragged to the streets.
Black Hawk Down. But Lee, have you ever heard the theory of the tiger at the gate? Do you know that? I mean, essentially, that's what you were talking about. Is that, this is in a primitive village, and if you can say there's a tiger at the gate and it's only, the leaders that can protect us, because we're pretty helpless. I mean, most of us feel pretty helpless in the face of these events over which we have no control, and, we don't want any more terrorism. I mean, the terrorism doesn't take a whole lot of lives throughout the world, and very, very few.
In the main.
Yeah. I mean, when it happens, a big one was 9/11. Since then, one person dying, the Boston Marathon was three people too many. We got to look to the basis of this. One thing, how do we deflect people's dislike for us? And well, part of it is we're
stop
over,
meddling.
We're over in their joint. Yeah.
A lot of me and my buddies, we encountered individuals where it's how do you fight these ideologies that's been in place for centuries. You actually have peoples in various regions of the earth that wish every man, woman, and child here in America actually perished off the face of the earth.
Do you know why part of that
and that's
is?
Actually, factual.
Okay, Lee, I agree with that. I couldn't agree more.
And
that
how,
is a fact.
But
do you know why? It's because we have been over there meddling in their business for all of these years and killing innocent civilians. It's really as simple as that. They're sick of our,
It's about, it began about 800 years ago. It was called the Crusades.
There, okay.
But then they came back at us. The Islamic forces invaded Europe. And I think where they were stopped, I don't know. So there's been, what we got to do is how do we find peace? This whole idea of peace through strength. Well, sometimes when you got the upper hand, it works. Sometimes when you let your guard slip, like 9/11, you get a punch. Usually we've been administering considerably more than we've been receiving. But this is pretty dramatic when, something like the scope of 9/11. All right, Lee, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. There's some open lines at 313-298-WRIF. Every couple of years, someone will call in, and you've been here when these calls have come in.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be a guy. He was driving through the inner city. He's like from, the whitest of all white suburbs. And
this isn't every couple of years. This is a couple of times every year. Go ahead.
And so the guy, it's always a guy, stops at an inner city gas station, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the stories are so identical. It's very, very bizarre.
True.
And they see a guy, they don't identify the race, but they see a guy pull up in a Cadillac.
Right.
Right? And then he goes into the gas station and buys cigarettes and booze and what have you with a bridge cart. Right? With
That's
a,
what they tell us they see.
That they see. And I never want to say, look, I've heard this story in its variants about 10 times, and the idea...
But you do say it.
Yeah. But one of the things I've started to say to them was, well, what do you think that tells us? And they go, huh? And I say, well, no, you saw somebody that was obviously violating the regulations, both by the store owner.
Yeah.
And also perhaps of somebody that didn't deserve this, that may have bought the card or something. So there was some violation of regulations, right?
Yeah.
And there's a silence like that. And I said, so, but what does that tell us? I mean, do you think that fraud is, like, widespread? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, or, yeah, let's go to the top.
Yeah.
Where the big fraud that matters is.
Okay, that's where I'm going with it. In all, well, I have to say, some liberals have brought up what's called corporate welfare. Because if...
And that includes us. We call it corporate wealth.
Oh, yeah. Right. But usually, so usually they come up with nothing. I mean, I would say, well, don't you think you had an obligation to report the store owner, the gas station owner, to the state of Michigan? Because they're all of these branches, because people are always trying to rob the government of different, you know, different programs, that you should have called them and said, look, here. But I said, I don't get why you called. He said, well, I just wanted to tell you. I said, okay, good. But I have never heard somebody who I suspect of being a racist, to tell you the truth. I mean, that's when it gets the down and the short.
Of course.
Huh, I wonder what that means.
because it's down and dirty to be
down and dirty,
to
the long and the short of it, yeah. That I've never heard one of these people ever complain about corporate welfare.
Yeah. How about
the
fat cats?
Yeah, and how about this? Millions in U.S. subsidies go to dead farmers. Now there's a Yeah, there's a farm bill that provides crop insurance and also subsidies, and sometimes farmers are paid not to produce, because capitalism is the only system in which a good crop is a curse. You know what I'm saying? In other words, if you need for consumption like 500,000 tons of potatoes, you got 600,000 tons of potatoes, the price drops.
Yeah.
And so this is this crop insurance is to make sure that farmers are supported. And you say, oh, yeah, you know, Farmer John and Farmer Brown and
Farm Aid, remember that?
And all that, yeah. But what we're talking about here is not family farms, which are few and far between these days, but corporate farms. And that's who gets so much of this money. Billions. The federal government pays millions of dollars in farm subsidies each year to farmers who have died because the agriculture department lacks the proper controls to make sure the money it sends is going to the right people. Now, and again, the Republicans have done everything they could to limit the enforcement ability of all of these programs.
Yeah. And people talk about, call in and bitch about government waste. Well, and we agree, you know, we start with the defense, but... Here's an example right here.
Yeah. The Natural Resources Conservation Service, which oversees the Agriculture Department's conservation programs, sent out $10.6 million in payments in 4 years to more than 1,000 people who have been dead for a year. So, but by the way, you know, the dead person wasn't cashing them, right?
Right.
A relative was, right, or something like that. The Risk Management Agency, which administers the crop insurance program, had paid $22 million to more than 3,400 policyholders who have been dead for at least 2 years.
My gosh.
It goes on and on like this. Controls over crop insurance in particular have been questioned after the government investigators found a huge fraud ring last year in North Carolina that for decades siphoned over $100 million from the program. The fraud ring included insurance agents, adjusters, farmers, and dozens of others. So, you know, don't, when you start worrying about welfare fraud.
About one person in one place that you say you saw did do that. And meanwhile, in America, that came out in an AP report, 4 in 5 in the U.S. facing near poverty and no work.
Yeah. Get this, though. So there's a concern, for instance, about how much these welfare recipients are sucking from the makers and giving it to the takers. The takers, of course. Now, there's no able-bodied men on receiving welfare payments. It's women with children, disabled people, elderly, and all that. But going to a conservative group, the Cato Institute argued that the United States fiscal policy allotted approximately $92 billion in 2006 federal budget towards program that the authors considered to be corporate welfare. That's $92 billion. who's this? Daniel D. Huff from Boise State University did this comprehensive study. This is 1993. Said that a very conservative estimate of corporate welfare expenditures in the United States would have been at least $170 billion as of 1990. The 1990 federal government. So this is, you know, do you think it's gotten better or worse? So
here, I'm going to go with worse.
Yeah. So here, $170 billion helping the corporations, the 1%, the ultra rich, $4.7 billion for all forms of international aid. That's back then. I mean, right now, Israel gets $3 billion a year by itself.
I thought it was more than that.
Well, no, they talk about $30 billion over 10 years.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Pollution control equipment, well, it goes on names of all this stuff. More to the point, while more than $170 billion is expended on assorted varieties of corporate welfare, the federal government spends $11 billion on aid for dependent children. You get what that means? Aid for dependent children? Right. The most expensive
So children can eat?
Yeah. The most expensive means-tested welfare program, Medicaid. That means you've got to have below a certain income, means-tested, in order to, that doesn't mean, you know, the Republicans, they just think that means to be mean to poor
That's
people.
Because they're mean, they think that way.
But means-tested, Medicaid costs the federal government $30 billion a year, about half of the amount half the amount that corporations receive each year through assorted tax breaks. SSI, the federal program for the disabled, $13 billion. So, if we could call in this these giveaways to the 1%, we wouldn't have a lot of the problems that we're having. And one of the places it could go, let me think if I could think of a city that might be able to use it.
Oh, it starts with a D.
It is the D, yeah. All right, let's go back to your calls. 313-298-WRIF, which is?
It's 313-298-9743.
Yes, okay. Here is Brian in Clinton. Brian, hi, you're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, hi, Peter. I have to say, I agree with you a lot on what you're talking about. The only thing that I'd have to protest is your comment about capitalism. And
what
I notice is about the corporate welfare, which is basically through subsidies, to my understanding, correct?
Yeah, what? I'm sorry, say that again.
The subsidies, you were speaking about subsidies with,
Right, yeah.
And what about any subsidy, any government subsidy, whether it comes from Republicans or Democrats, is socialism.
And
corporativism. Like, when you support corporations, it's all corporativist.
Yeah.
It's not capitalism.
And that, by the way, that is across the board. I mean, that's the Republicans and the Democrats.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. I'm a libertarian myself.
Yeah.
So, like, I kind of, I'm on both sides, of, you know, but yeah. It's just, I see a lot of people and they blame capitalism. All capitalism is voluntary trade. But when you have governments taking money from the poor people and giving them to rich cats, like you guys are saying, that's all socialism.
Well,
and I mean, it's crony capitalism. It's socialism. It's corporativism.
Well, you know, usually libertarians like the 18th century economic philosopher Adam Smith.
Adam Smith is one of my favorites.
Well, if you read into it, he says it takes 500 poor men to make one rich man.
Okay. people are making money, but
here's the problem with for one thing, there's never been a free market really to speak of. I mean, it's there's nothing wrong with utopian visions or trying to make reality adhere as much as possible to what one's beliefs are. But there is a tendency towards monopolization. So when you talk about a free market, you have to have undistinguished sellers and easy entrance and exit from the market where, beginning, I don't know, as early as the 1840s, but certainly by the 1890s, all the markets were dominated by these corporate giants.
My only question to that would be is how much regulation was put in place and written by corporations in order to protect themselves from actual free market trade.
Well, here's what happened under, let's go to the meat industry. One of the big, the biggest supporters of the Meats Act, how do these things get stuck in your mind? The Meats Act, I think that was into the 20th century. I mean, there was, because of the free market, because of no strict regulation, because of no inspection, people were just getting the worst possible adulterated food. I mean, you read The Jungle by Upton Sinclair.
Ugh, changed my life.
But Swift and Armour, the big meat packing companies, were all for government regulation. So think about this as, you said you're kind of on both sides. This as a sword with two sides. Because on one hand, the Meats Inspection Act allowed for exactly that, to get the terrible adulterated and spoiled meat, slaughtering dead cows and all the horrible stuff. On the other hand, it created this near monopolization for Swift and Armour.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I believe it happens in many industries.
Oh, I'd say all.
That's just like an open debate for all of us to really kind of figure out, like, where is that sweet spot between overregulation and no regulation?
All right, Brian, thank you very much. Appreciate your comments. Appreciate you calling in.
Where is that sweet spot?
Where is that sweet spot? Indeed. Let's go back a little. You were starting to hit on that. I thought you were going to go more into it. This sounded on the face of it kind of crazy, that 4 in 5, that 80% of us face near poverty
facing
or no work.
Near poverty or near work, yeah.
Well, it says that 4 out of 5 U.S. adults struggle with joblessness, near poverty, or reliance on welfare for at least part of their lives, a sign of deteriorating economic security and an elusive American dream. I don't mean to ruin anybody's night.
This
but
is pretty depressing.
Forget about the American dream.
Yeah. But
that was something that they made up in, like, I don't know when, the
1950s. It was the 50s, I was going to say.
Yeah. Well, let me ask people. You can call in to 313-298-WRIF. Did you face joblessness, near poverty, or reliance on welfare for at least part of your life? Did you, Jillian, ever?
Are you?
I never.
No, I've worked steadily since I was a teenager, but no. But I sure have been, and do have a lot of friends who are in that situation.
Starting to slip. Starting to see more.
Yeah, I've been in relationships with people who are in that situation.
And one of the ways that racial discrimination and racism worked was to first exclude people of color for competing for the good jobs and jobs in general. But now, because all edges of the economy are beginning to fray, that it where is this in here? That the distinction between races is beginning to equalize. That in other words, that people are, you know, we may have racial equality in this massive poverty in the richest country in the world.
Yeah.
And let's see where it says, hardship is particularly growing among whites based on several measures. Pessimism among whites about their families' economic futures that climbed to the highest point. The pessimism has climbed to the highest point since 1987. In the most recent poll from the Associated Press, 63% of white people called the economy poor. I know the other 27. We always talk about the 1%, but, you know, that was my prediction. Remember that what we're going to wind up, unless we all do something, we're going to wind up with a country that has a third of its population living like what we define as a middle-class lifestyle. And the bottom two-thirds, depending on how close you are to the 66th percentile, is going to get, here comes that word again, getting meaner and meaner and meaner as you go down to the bottom of the pyramid.
Yeah, and none of this surprises me. I remember when we were on the air in 2001 and everything erupted in the world again. And, I mean, Peter, we predicted this, that it was just going to go downhill and downhill and downhill. None of this is a shock or a surprise. But what needs to change? What needs to happen? A lot.
Yeah, and what happened, for instance, during the 1930s, a lot of the fight back, a lot of the demands for middle class and working class people and the poor were led by the labor unions. And when you see protests against austerity in Brazil and Greece and
yes.
Italy and everywhere. It's led by the labor unions, and now the labor unions are almost gone. So,
dwindling.
So if everyone's out there saying, yeah, I absolutely agree with you and we got to fight back, how do we do it? You know, what's the mechanism through which all of this occurs? And things can be reinvented. Maybe if the unions aren't going to come back, then what?
What's the alternative?
You can hope.
And I would like to see, you know, when we see these austerity, anti-austerity rallies around the world, that we do see images of on television or on the internet. We need those many people out in our streets, and we just can't get them out there, Peter.
Yeah. Well, again, it's what happens is that, the organization apparatus is like a trade union in Brazil or in Greece.
Yeah.
And they call a general strike. That means, you know, everything is shut down.
And we're not able to have that.
Yeah. I mean, you and I, we could call for let's have a general strike on Tuesday, you know, like that. So.
No, we still want our job. No.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But, here are some of the things that are happening, over 10 million American households in the United States lack a banking account. And what happens is that poor people, because they've bounced a check or have a small overdraft, have been blacklisted. This is actually for, what did they say? Oh, I mean, it's not all because of this. 1 million low-income Americans have been blacklisted from the mainstream financial system for as long as 7 years because they have these little-known private databases that are used by the major banks. And I wonder if any of this has happened to you. Have you been denied a bank account? I thought, you show up with $50 and they take it.
Like a confession.
Well, I was going to say, you have the confession look on your face.
I know the confession look, and and once in a while, but it was many moons ago, and I lived here, and I, Peter, I'm not the best with my money, handling my money, but I was really bad then, and I can't remember what it was. I owed a bank money, and then I paid it and everything, but they marked me on this list. I moved to Miami. Get right in and get a bank account, no problem. Everything's cool. You know, you and I were working. We were nationally syndicated. There was money coming in.
Right.
And I came back here. I had my poop in a group, as they say, and I could not get a checking account.
They wouldn't
in
give
Michigan.
It to you?
No. I had to go through this whole rigmarole and this and that, and I had to basically just kind of get a little crazy on these people, and they finally cleared me. It took me like 3-4 weeks of this. And for the people who can't even get past that, they're screwed.
Yeah, it must be tough. As you know, I have a family treasurer. And
yes,
my wife.
Your wife.
And
lucky. I need one of those.
I hear her on the phone all the time talking to the bank. And I say, what was that about? And she said, oh, I just remember.
Yeah. And you prefer it that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
It works.
Jonathan Mintz, the commissioner of New York City's Department of Consumer Affairs, says banks' growing reliance on consumer databases has frustrated efforts to help an estimated 825,000 New Yorkers without bank accounts. Wow. And
wow.
He says hundreds of thousands of Americans are being shut out for relatively small mistakes.
Well, and it makes a big, huge difference. It's hard to get things done.
Sure.
Often when you don't have a bank account, it's very inconvenient.
Well, I was listening to my favorite conservative, which, I mean, I despise, my favorite conservative commentator as I'm coming into work.
Every week we say this. Why do you do this?
And interestingly, they are sounding some of the same alerts that we and people to the right of us, like liberals, are saying as well. That his phrase, I like that word, that... he said the policies of Bush and Obama were hollowing out the middle class. Well, the middle class is being hollowed out, and that goes way back to Reaganomics. But he was talking about, like, the growing number of people on food stamps. Mm-hmm. And what this really is, it's a picture of a nation becoming increasingly poor.
Yes.
Well, no.
Consistently increasingly.
I wanted to be more precise.
Okay.
Of a nation, of a wealthy nation with an increasing number of poor people in it,
mm-hmm.
which it has to be. The only other way that it can be done is redistribute the wealth.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I love it. That'll get everybody going. That'll get everybody going. Some of these, I don't know if you saw this article, making $775 an hour and figuring there's little to lose by speaking out. Now, listen,
and this has been going on for a little while. This is good.
I know that when people think about entertainers, of which, and Jillian and I are in the entertainment industry, we must just be fabulously wealthy,
making
six and seven figure salaries and all that.
I sleep on the finest sheets and I throw money around just for kicks.
Yeah, but like most industries, it's the salaries aren't going north; they're going south.
Yeah.
And yet, like, I went to breakfast. You know, we had a house guest, and we met my wife's a bunch of people. And so, who did I? For some reason or other, I picked up the check for breakfast. For breakfast.
Yeah.
At this restaurant. For four of us, and when everybody didn't eat a lot, $54 with the tip.
Yeah.
Well, you know, actually, that doesn't even turn out to be that much, does it?
Well, it depends on who you are.
Yeah.
Sometimes $10 is too much.
Well, I know, but I was thinking that's only with the tip, that's only like 10 and a quarter. I mean, you can go to some of these places and get breakfast for $2.29, right?
Yeah. you can get some really, really bad crap at a fast food restaurant for like two for a dollar.
Well,
I don't do it.
Or you can go to IKEA. They give breakfast for $1.79.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I've never been there.
Yeah. Anyway, the point being that I could do this. And then I think about this. Somebody's making $7.75 an hour. I mean, that's, you know, there's something wrong here.
Yeah. It's rough and it's unfair.
Yeah, but let me see.
That's what why we talk constantly about a fair and living wage on this show.
This is kind of a long piece. Maybe we ought to post this. But there is, where is this? Oh, I see what I did. I stapled it wrong. But there is great ferment brewing. The article says the car washers of the Bronx and Brooklyn have voted to form unions, as have security guards at Kennedy Airport. Twice in the past 9 months, fast food workers, with the aid of Fast Food Forward, a community organizing and labor coalition, have rallied and demanded higher wages and an end to wage theft, which is, means the, they're just not getting properly paid. And there was just one here in Detroit the other day. And this, I don't know whether I got some release. You know, it's funny. I lost it from my email. It was either from some restaurant group or some grocers group.
Yeah.
And they were talking, oh, you know, a raise in the minimum wage is terrible, and look what happens when now, because of the demand of the government, that firms with over 50 workers have to provide health insurance, that they're actually driving people into part-time work so they won't have to pay them.
Yeah. The wave.
Yeah. So what, and they're saying, oh, this is great entry level wages, which is not true. And particularly when you have an economy that where the wage structure is collapsing for the bottom two thirds, these aren't entry levels. This is peasant wages that are going to be constant. And this is why, and actually on my website at Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, .com. Let me see. Let me get to this. There are these, there's this movement now. There's this movement now called, what are they called? Oh, Strike for 15. That's right.
Okay, what's that?
$15 an hour minimum wage.
Oh, okay.
That can qualify as a living wage. And there's something wrong what if a company said, well, I'm going to go in business and I'm going to hire 52 people. But because of the cash I have and the revenue I'm expecting, I only can afford to pay people $3 an hour. Maybe these companies that say, I can't afford to give people health insurance, I can't pay to pay $15 an hour, maybe they don't belong in business.
Maybe not.
Maybe not. What you think? Tell me about this.
A couple phone calls on hold.
Okay, I'll
so
get
we'll
them.
Get to those.
Oh, hear about this. This is not replacing the Koch brothers, but Papa John's chief executive, John Shatner, makes
funny.
$2 million a year and lives on a medieval estate outside Louisville, Kentucky.
That's all? Aw.
He spoke recently of trying to subvert Obamacare's provisions by cutting the hours of all of his workers to less than 30 hours. Yum Brands, which owns KFC and Taco Bell, and whose chief executive makes $11.3 billion per year, helped lead the battle against paid sick days. These MFs.
Against, people can't get sick now?
Well, they don't want paid sick days.
That's,
just,
that,
Yeah. These people are evil. When you think about, and this, by the way, you know, this was capitalism without regulation, without laws governing wages, without laws governing safety, without laws governing wages and hours and time, you know, overtime and all of that. And it, there's something about these wealthy son of a bitches, excuse me, if you got kids up, that have no heart. Some of them do. There are people there. There are people, they you know, even this Buddhist concept called right livelihood. And I know people that own firms that own, you know, and
we know wealthy people.
Well, yeah. And Costco and Myers and places like that. They do
the right thing.
They do the right thing.
Mostly.
But these guys, it's like my money.
Yeah,
nobody's taking my money. Where the hell do you think you got it? They're running your damn stores. What awful people you are.
How do you live with yourselves?
Yes. How do you sleep at night?
Yep.
Quite soundly,
they do, Peter. That's how bad they are.
I hope not.
Yeah. Make sure you're looking at the time, by the way.
Okay. The time. Okay. Let me take this call, though, and let me see. Jim and Keith and Al will be right to you. Here is Jim in Ann Arbor. Jim, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're good. Great. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, I just wanted to, put my two cents in. I mean, with companies, you can't go on strike because anybody can, they'll pick up a guy and train them how to do your job for less. Because
I think
so many people are looking
thing
for
called
jobs.
A scab, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's so many people starving for it that's impossible now.
Sure.
You don't have that workforce out there that, you know, are special trades because everybody teaches everybody now. When you got, like, the job I last had, there was a guy, I don't have a degree. I worked the same job as a guy with a master's degree.
Wow.
And they trained me how to do the job that he did, the same thing, and he had a master's degree. So, like, nowadays college isn't getting you that job that you're supposed to have.
Yeah, I hear a lot
and
about
plus
that.
You wind up with being $20,000 to $100,000 in debt. Hey, well, you know, you go to college for 4 years and you're 22, or say you go to graduate school and you're 24 or 25, and you say, okay, I'm going to get a great job and I owe $78,000, right?
Exactly. So you're going to take any job, even if it has nothing to do with your degree.
Yeah, because they're, you know, the government's demanding the loan back. And that's why, what's Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts? She's trying to pass a bill that student loans would have an interest rate. I think they finally passed this thing where they reduced it back down to 3.4 or whatever it is. That she said it should be at the Fed preferred rate. So in other words, it should be, you know, the government should be loaning students money at zero. But even better, and this is what I'm talking about, that, and it's not here yet. I mean, this is fanciful. It's not happening. That there ought to be a demand from students and their parents that just like high school is free, college should be free. I mean, we always talk about the importance of education. It's about the future leaders of our country.
Yeah.
So why are we impoverishing people and their families, or deterring people that couldn't even think, wow, why should I go? Let me see, I'm going to work. I'm not going to make any money for 4 to 6 years, and I'm going to have $60,000 in debt. So, and also there should be a movement, what's called a jubilee, that all of the debt, all student debt ought to just be wiped out and, let everybody, get the educational opportunities that depend not on money, but on their ability and what we see for their future role in our country. All right, Jim, thank you very, I wanted to ask you one question. You said there was a clip from the HBO series Newsroom that said.
The Newsroom.
Yeah, this is, we're no longer the richest country in the world?
The best country in the world. And he, like, gave out all the facts, about, where we're at. Yeah. Have you ever seen that?
No, but I have done it on my own. Because when you start thinking about all of the, what they call the social indices, in other words, how do you measure a successful country? We're like a failed state. We have this extremely high infant mortality rate. We're nowhere near the top of age expectancy. We have the most expensive health care system that's available to the least amount of people of any industrialized country. Low literacy rate. I can't even,
The list is.
The list goes on. I mean, you look for something in which the United States is number one, other than compressed wealth at the top of the 1%, and you're hard pressed to find anything. All right. Thank you very much, Jim. I appreciate your comments. and Keith and Al and Nick right back to you after these.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much. Welcome back for our final segment. 1 a.m., I'm going to be interviewing Norman Solomon, one of the founders of the Institute for Public Accuracy. And he's going to comment on the Bradley Manning conviction, the young soldier who released all of these records to WikiLeaks. And he is going to call for his nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize. And also, PFC Manning has been nominated by a past Nobel Peace Prize laureate, as they call him, a woman named McGuire, who I think is probably the activist from Northern Ireland.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Magrid. Maybe that's it. Magrid McGuire, indeed.
One email, Peter. This is from Scott. He said he has a new definition for capitalism. He's calling it institutionalized greed. That is all it is. And he said, love your show. Thanks, Scott.
Well, I mentioned earlier the 18th century economic philosopher Adam Smith, who said that for every rich man, it takes 500 poor men.
Yeah.
But he saw greed as okay. I mean, but he called it like self-interest. Everyone seeking their own self-interest, which it's totally, let me finish the thought, that by everyone seeking their own self-interest, that the general interest will be served. Well, that's nonsense. It's almost immediately with the establishment of capitalism in the, depending on where you pin it, but let's talk about particularly the 17th, 18th century and going into the 19th century, the most aggressive, greedy, mean-spirited people were the ones that were also the innovators. They mm-hmm. were the ones that established the factories. They were the ones that created the monopolies in railroad and oil and everything under the sun. They were the ones that, and kept their workers working, you know, 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, nothing. You worked for the company store. All right, let's go back to our phones. Here's Keith in Ypsilanti. Keith, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Okay, how's it going, Jolene and Peter?
It's good. Sure,
excellent. Hello.
Okay, well, I think I'm one of those poor people that you referred to earlier.
Okay.
I basically, I wasn't one of the college type people, so I took up printing actually in high school, and it took good care of me for years until the home printers came and took the business cards and letterhead, and then went to the larger presses, and then a lot of the magazines went to the internet. But what amazes me, I've been working for a temporary agency now for 3 years, and as you know, temporary agencies, you just work nonstop. We've been working 7 days a week since the first of the year. I'm poorer than I've ever been. Mm. I don't get vacation because that's not how temporary agencies work. And it's just amazing to me how no one sees what this whole environment, I believe, partly is created by maybe one too many jobs being outsourced. So now we've got emergency managers coming into cities across the country. It's not just Detroit. And people seem as though they don't understand that those outsourced jobs were paying into the municipality's tax base.
Sure.
So you got these abandoned apartments across the city of Detroit, and those were mostly non-college jobs that were lost. And I just think at some point the outsourcing helped to create the temporary agencies. And it's a lot like, and I'm going to let this thing go, what I'm going through right now is a lot like me having a woman come into my house. She cleans for me. She cooks for me. She has my babies. But I won't give her the name. I won't give her my name. The companies will not give temporary workers the company name.
Well, I hear you, Keith. You know, part of it is that we, from the last three, four generations, we had these expectations that it was called the American Dream. We always thought, and everybody's heard this a million times, that each successive generation was going to do better than the last one. You know, the worker at Ford, his son would get a college degree and become a lawyer or a doctor.
Yeah.
But during the 19th century, it was just you did what the boss said, and there were no regulations. That's what, like, these libertarians love and all that, and there was no constraints on this. People, so they got incredibly wealthy. People lived short, miserable lives that revolved around
because they worked so hard.
We literally worked people to death. I mean, the initial wealth of capitalism in this country is on the bones of two elements. One, of course, is slavery, which was really the original basis of wealth in the United States, and the other was the super exploitation of white workers in the 17th and 18th century, and into the 20th century. Finally, there was a bit of upward mobility in the 1930s because the government intervened severely to create rights for workers, created the basis for the middle class by actually redistributing billions of dollars of wealth, spreading it out. And now we're going back to where it was. We're going back to the 19th century. All right, thank you very much, Keith. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Here is Nick. Nick's in Fraser. Go ahead, Nick. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Going good.
Good. Yeah, I was calling in because after listening to some of your libertarian callers, like one of the guys that called in earlier,
they
all seem to claim to be huge supporters of capitalism and de facto experts on it. But the more I listen to libertarians, the more I see they have no clue what capitalism actually is. Like the guy who called in earlier saying he was libertarian, he said that capitalism is simply voluntary trade of goods and services. Well, then he's not really talking about capitalism. He's talking about a barter system. They don't have much in common. And I also imagine most of these libertarian callers sell their labor to a capitalist who underpays them for it. And on top of that, they make excuses for the capitalist along the lines of them being overregulated, overtaxed, so that's why they can't pay them fairly. And even if that were the case, which it isn't, would they let you go back to a time when workers didn't have weekends, overtime, you know, workplace safety guidelines, and capitalists could poison their communities without any form of retribution?
Well, here is just another historic example. In beginning in the late 18th century, when woolen production, you know, clothing and all that, was done in these small little home units, sometimes with maybe a couple employees, sometimes just families and what have you, and they were ruined by these power looms. I mean, so technology had a role in this as well. But something called the enclosures, the common areas, were gobbled up by capitalists who then owned the land that previously had been available to everyone to, like, graze and what have you. So you got this. That was what the working class, what they called then the proletariat, streamed into London. If you've ever seen any of those movies with London, it's just this foul pit of crime and disease and all that. Yeah. It's because, and that happened all over the world, happened in the United States, as people flocked into the cities and became people that had no option other than to sell their labor at whatever the owner decided the price would be. That would be the market, which would be real, real, real low. So when anybody ever talks about the free market, you got to hold on to your wallet because you're about to get robbed. You don't want a free market, particularly in labor. We all be working for $3 an hour if the free market in employment held. Well, you know, with the exception of there are, you know, doctors wouldn't, and maybe people that are salesmen that are selling, you know, lots of stuff. But the average person, the average working person, is the last thing in the world he or she wants is a free market. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. And let's see, Al has been waiting patiently in Detroit. Al, thanks for joining us on the air. Go ahead. Hey, Al.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Jolene.
Hi, Al.
Just a couple of things. For people that aren't making a lot of money, or for people, anybody, that works for a living, they're not paying you enough. People need to stop depending on the companies to hire them and give them what they think are going to be a fair wage. What needs to happen is each person needs to realize they need to look at their life sort of as a business. figure something out, manage the money, what they do have, and find something about themselves to exploit and find a way for themselves to make money for themselves, or get groups of like-minded people together to start new companies or new businesses or organizations that they think are more fair and equitable. If more people didn't look to these fast food joints and these companies just to provide them with jobs, sure, it would take some time and effort, but people have the talent, the ability to do this, no matter, you know, who they are. It's just, you know, to look at life more as a person that's going to produce rather than consume, because people are trained to be big consumers.
Right.
So even people with the money they're making, you see people out buying stuff everywhere like crazy, ridiculous stuff that they don't need.
Well, and, you know, it's tough when you're a parent. Say you're a poor parent, and everywhere you look, you turn on the television, you see everyone around you. They've got the latest in styles. They got the latest in electronics. And any poor parent or that has to tell their kid, no, I'm sorry, you can't have that. And the disappointment and how the kid feels. So, but, you know, Al, you've hit it right on the head. I mean, the consumer society that was needed, that kind of ethos was needed in order to expand sales. In other words, the worst thing that can ever happen to capitalism is stasis. People say, well, they're worried that this back to school season is not going to increase over last year.
Yeah.
So you're always going to have this incredible increase forever. Well, I mean, after a while, I don't think it's either certainly not financially possible, and ecologically. I mean, how much stuff can we all have?
The planet take?
And there are people in Detroit, Al, which you may be familiar with, that are saying, look, we are now thrown on our own resources. We're not going to work those kind of jobs that our parents had, maybe at Chrysler or Bud Wheel or some of the supplier shops or something like that. The government is probably going to be cutting back on services and what have you. And we're going to have to reinvent life together, and we're going to have to do it in a manner that that doesn't have that dependency on the big bureaucracies.
I call it hippie communities. What do we call those? Communes. Didn't you used to live on one of those, Peter?
Yeah, man. All right, Al. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Let's see. Here's Matt. Matt's in Richmond. Hey, Matt. You're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing, Peter? How you doing, Julie?
We're good.
Great.
Yeah, I was trying to talk about the education system a little bit, and well, I've noticed a lot. I mean, especially with me, personally, I'm a young student. I'm 25 years old. I go to college, you know, going for an associate's degree. But I've noticed a lot of different things going on with it. You know, we're going to school, and I heard a lot of people tonight so far talking about how they're actually learning their jobs a lot better without having that college degree. But also at the same time, when you're in school, how poorly failing it's actually becoming. So you're expecting teachers to teach you, but all they're doing is implementing into greed is what I like to, really call it. Now, if you have that happening and you're trying to go to school to learn a particular subject, you would expect that teacher to be able to actually teach you that particular subject you're trying to learn.
Sure.
But it does not happen that way anymore. So
you're saying that the quality of education is slipping? Is that what your point is?
Big time.
Okay. Yeah, you're there.
Also, and also what I've noticed as well, you know, why pay $40,000 to go to school? I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, it's a good thing. It makes you look good on your resume, all that other things. But in the end, what's it really fighting for when I can go on the internet myself and I can learn from other people all around the world how to do certain individual things?
Yeah, you know,
no cost.
I'm not trying to get a compliment out of you, but don't I sound like I know a little about some stuff?
Oh, you know a little about a lot.
Yeah,
you know,
well, that's about it.
I guess to say jack of all
things. Never graduated.
I never graduated college.
And I did.
I never graduated.
There you go.
I never graduated college, so it's not necessary.
You know, but the thing is, you're self-taught, and most people, that's a rare gift. That's what I see. You know, I mean, it's, you know, I find fascination with many things, you know, whether it's history, whether it's economical, whether it's political, whether it's other different things that are also a necessity to understand in your mind, too.
A lot of people, and I feel bad for a lot of people who aren't getting their money's worth, especially everywhere around the world. And we're paying for people who are making the biggest mistakes of all and not actually looking and realizing what their true problem is.
Hey, Matt, what are you studying?
I'm studying a lot of computer technology. Looking for network systems.
Yeah, now that
a lot of computer stuff.
Right. Now that, you know, that has potential. I mean,
that has legs.
But it used to be, you know, people would say, you know, what are you studying? Philosophy. Well, woo, you know.
Oh, I mean, anybody can be in
political science.
Yeah, there you go.
Everybody's so a natural born philosopher.
Ron Crichton, who's coming on the air after us, is back there, who is into all of that. Is that, that's what he would study. He's flipping us off. That's his degree. Yeah, but you use it in conversation. Come on, Ron.
Everybody's a natural born philosopher. I mean, but that's just, it's a lot of common things. You observe nature for the way it truly is. You know, you see the order of things and how it works, and you notice just over time. So.
Okay. Well, thank you. Keep it your studies, hopefully you won't come out with a tremendously enormous debt.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Matt. And if you do, hopefully you can get a job and pay for it.
Here's the worst case scenario. This, I really believe, is going to come about unless we, and I know some of you hate this word, collectively intervene in our future. And we can either be an object of history, in other words, as individuals, just hope or even try. Sometimes people, you know, a lot of people try real hard and it doesn't come about. Or we can just hope that that things go better our way. But I would see a system in the next 20 years or so that for the top third, as I was saying earlier, the top third of people live like the Woodward Corridor from Ferndale up through Birmingham. That's kind of, and that's where most of all the money is going to circulate, all the, you know, production and consumption and what have you. And it'll look just like it always has without any problem. The bottom two thirds, it depends on how close you are to the 66th percentile. If you're, you know, if you're in the 60th percentile, you'll do okay. You're like lower middle class or upper working class. But then as you get down, it's going to get worse and worse. Cash disappears. No more cash. There'll be a universal consumer producer card, the other way around, a universal producer consumer card.
You know, microchip on me over there?
Yeah, something like that. So, you know, you have this card, and I mean, because, like I've told you before, I do very, very little with cash.
Yep.
My paycheck is, what do they call it? Direct deposit.
Yeah. Wife goes.
And you charge, yeah, and you charge things. So, I mean, it's half the way there with a lot of people. Anyway, but it's whether we become what they call the subject in history. In other words, we make history. The people have done that any number of times throughout history, and we learn about it, and we idealize those people, everybody from, you know, Martin Luther King to George Washington and what have you. And these were just the individuals. But behind all these people were these individuals were a huge movement that made all this happen.
It did happen, and hopefully it won't crumble completely.
Yeah.
We have to have hope.
We got to have hope. Miles and miles of hope.
No, that's not enough.
We have to have right. Okay, thank you for listening. Jefferson, thanks for doing the phones. There'll
be
a podcast available in about 11 hours. In just a few minutes, I'm going to be interviewing Norman Solomon of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He's going to discuss the implications of the Bradley Manning conviction and also talking about a petition to nominate Bradley Manning for the Nobel Peace Prize. If you go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, if you'd like to support the petition urging Manning to be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, you can go there. And also, Minky Warden. She wrote a book called The Unfinished Revolution, Voices from the Global Fight for Women's Rights.
I love it.
You love it. All right. Thank you very much. Stay tuned for the interviews, and we'll do it all again next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Mike Rowe here. So I'm at a Ford dealer talking with customers about how taking care of your car is kind of like taking care of yourself. And I ask, which is in better shape, you or your car? Hint, the answer has four wheels.
get the works. An oil change, tire rotation, and more for $39.95 or less minus a $10 mail-in rebate. That's $29.95. Click on the banner ad now. Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, and disposal fees extra. Rebate by check. See participating Ford dealer for exclusions and rebate details through 8/31/13.
Ever hear somebody say we can do this the easy way or we can do it the hard way? I mean, what kind of a choice is that? At Geico.com, everything's easy. Easy to see how much you can save on car insurance. Easy to go paperless by automatically paying your bill online. Easy, easy, easy. So visit Geico.com today. Of course, if you prefer the hard way, I guess you'll have to go someplace else. Sorry, I just don't get it.
Are you self-employed, stuck on COBRA, or did your health insurance rates just take a huge jump?
Listen to this.
I'm Josh Cush of J.P. Cush & Associates. You've seen the signs. And when I founded J.P. Cush & Associates, I promised myself that my customers would always get the best health coverage at the lowest rates. Call me now at 855-4-JP-CUSH before the rates go up even more.
That's 855-4-JP-CUSH to get a quote today.
That's 855-457-5874.
Or go to jpkush.com. J.P. Cush & Associates. 855-457-5874.
Hey, Larry, mind if I sit down?
Nope.
This coffee tastes like coffee. So what's going on?
Not much.
What's new?
Not much.
Okay, but can you please put the newspaper down while you say not much?
What newspaper?
This newspaper. Oh, dude, what happened to your face? I see one, two,
ow,
three, four, five, six.
Ow.
Dude, what is
ow
this? 11 pieces of toilet paper stuck to your face?
I'm shaving in the dark to save energy. I'm helping the environment.
Well, that's a dangerous way to help the environment.
Well, sometimes you have to sacrifice yourself for the greater good.
Dude, there's an easier and safer way to help the environment without sacrificing yourself. Go green, go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment and you won't have to live behind a newspaper.
Wow.
But for now, put the newspaper back up.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
101 WRIF. Oh!
a free extra gift, and free.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Dave and Chuck the Freak Mornings. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Probably over the years, the guest I've had the most on the air is Norman Solomon. Norman Solomon has done so many things with the progressive movement that has added to its dimension and its scope. He is one of the co-founders of the Institute for Public Accuracy. Probably the last book he's written, although he's written several more, is War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. He's also the co-founder of RootsAction.org. And we last spoke to Norman not so long ago because he was preparing, his organization, RootsAction.org, was preparing a petition nominating Bradley Manning for the Nobel Peace Prize. Bradley Manning probably needs a little introduction now, but he's the U.S. soldier that was just convicted for sharing deep U.S. secrets with WikiLeaks, which were then published abroad. He was acquitted of the most severe charge, I think we're all aware of that, of aiding the enemy. And that, in fact, in the New York Times was the headline, you know, not guilty of aiding the enemy. I thought, this is great, he's going to be walking home. No, he's still facing 136 years on the other charges. But let's talk a little more with Norman Solomon. We're reaching him at his office in San Francisco about the petition that RootsAction.org has put forth to nominate Bradley Manning for the Nobel Peace Prize and the implications of the trial. Norman Solomon, welcome back. You're, like I said, you hold the record, buddy.
Hey, thanks, Peter.
Well, we know all the news. I've kind of summarized that, and we want to flesh it out. But so this is an odd way to start our conversation. But I was listening to NPR yesterday, and I don't know if you heard it, but they had this long section with an author, a New Yorker magazine writer, with this psychological portrait of Bradley Manning and all the personal and political conflicts he had in his life. But particularly what struck me was the psychological portrait they were trying to draw of him. Do you think that's of any relevance?
Well, it's really not of much political relevance at all, but for those who are more interested in sort of navel-gazing or pop psychology, it's certainly preferable to actually dealing with substance, especially for many pundit vantage points, because the substance is so challenging. It confronts basic assumptions that most of the mainline media pundits, and I say mainline rather than mainstream because I think there's a rather negative addictive quality to so much of the corporate and Pentagon-fed perspectives on issues such as war and secrecy. Ultimately, the pop psychology is a last refuge of, if not scoundrels, then at least just a bunch of BS. I mean, we should remember that 40-plus years ago, when Daniel Ellsberg went on trial for release of the Pentagon Papers, there was a huge amount of that sort of thing dwelling on him as a personality and so forth. You could do that with anyone.
Sure.
You could have done it with Martin Luther King or anyone. But the fact is, that Bradley Manning has provided a tremendous service, which includes illuminating the way in which our government, the U.S. government, relies on war and secrecy to prevent democratic discussion in our own country.
Mm-hmm. Now, Norman Solomon, your organization, RootsAction.org, has launched a petition nominating Bradley Manning for a Nobel Peace Prize. He's now a convicted criminal. He is convicted on some very serious charges by the United States Army. Does that have any bearing on your continuation of this process?
Oh, not at all. I think Bradley Manning's moral stature remains just as high after the verdict as before. You know, when it comes to Nobel Peace Prize, we have examples, a couple in our lifetimes, of people who were not able to go to Oslo to receive the prize because they were in detention. In the case of Aung San Suu Kyi, as I'm remembering, 19 91. She got the Nobel Peace Prize. The dictators in Miramar, formerly Burma, wouldn't let her go to receive it because she was under house arrest. Then a few years ago, 2010, you had a dissident in prison in China. He got the Nobel Peace Prize. Chinese government didn't let him go to accept it at the ceremony in Oslo. Now, we in the United States are encouraged to have the conceit that we don't need or have those kind of dissidents. But in fact, we do. We do in a country that is in perpetual war and that relies, unfortunately, through the government anyway, a reliance on keeping us in the dark. And Peter, you know, the sort of the cliche about how you, I guess you grow mushrooms, and I can't probably say it fully given the FCC strictures, but you know, you keep them in the dark and you feed them a bunch of manure. And this is really how the U.S. public is treated by the White House and State Department and Pentagon when it comes to war issues. So I think that's a lot of what is so crucial about what Bradley Manning did. He leaked enormous quantities of information. Most of it was routine. None of it was top secret. Just a couple of examples.
Sure.
The so-called collateral murder video. And if you go to YouTube and you type in collateral murder, you will see a video that has about 14 million views. That's because in 2010, courtesy of and thanks to the courage of Bradley Manning, WikiLeaks released this secret video, which showed a couple of U.S. Apache gunships in the air from their vantage point over Baghdad, killing civilians, including a couple of Reuters reporters. And what's most chilling about that video is the soundtrack. Not just that it's like a turkey shoot, but the absolute flippant, blatant, joyous way, the chilling way that the banter went on among those in the U.S. military who were shooting. Now, we never would have seen this. It never would have reached the light of day if not for Bradley Manning taking something that was secret. And another example is a U.S. diplomatic cable that made clear that in a village in Iraq, there had been a massacre of 10 civilians, several of them children under 5 years old, and then a U.S. airstrike was called in to cover up the massacre by U.S. soldiers. Again, we never would have known this without Bradley Manning. And so imagine yourself being at that point, as Bradley Manning was, you're 22 years old. You're sitting at a computer in Iraq. You see that kind of video and that kind of cable, and you have a choice. Do you just turn your head as though you don't see it, or do you take action to bring to the light of day what are really war crimes? And to his credit, that's what he did.
Norman Solomon is my guest. He's from rootsaction.org. You can go there. You can also go to his website, normansolomon.com, and I'll have links on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Another, I should remember or write down these people I'm quoting from NPR, but there was another commentator said that it was good that this information got out to the public, but Manning deserved the guilty verdict. I went, whoa, how do we deal with that one? How do you deal with it?
Yeah, it's a sort of a strange twist of illogic that some folks have enunciated, and I think it sort of reflects ambivalence that people feel. It's like, yeah, you should do the right thing, and then you should be punished for it. It's sort of, I guess, the Stockholm Syndrome idea that those who are keeping you imprisoned mentally and perhaps physically, that you should identify with your guards instead of yourself and your quest for freedom and, you know, solidarity with others. I guess it's an internalized acceptance of authority. And
Wait a minute. Let me put another spin on it. And so maybe it's a little more challenging. And that could be one of the explanations, absolutely. But the other thing was that it is excellent that an informed public get the information they need in order to make decisions about wars or surveillance or what have you. On the other hand, it brings in the question, are these laws like the 1917 Espionage Act that Bradley Manning was facing and some of the other charges, are they necessary in other regard? Because you could say if Snowden is innocent, if Bradley Manning should have been innocent, why couldn't, say, just a spy for China say, well, I was just trying to do the right thing? So the idea being that the laws are important to have. It was good that we got the information from the leaker, the whistleblower, the lawbreaker.
Well, I think whistleblower is the key word there, because to apply the 1917 Espionage Act to whistleblowers is a new thing, and it's a very dangerous thing. Whistleblowers, Bradley Manning, Ed Snowden, Daniel Ellsberg, did they aid the enemy? Were they engaged in espionage? Well, by no definition were they. They were bringing to the light of day what the U.S. public, I think, largely wanted to know about if they could have access to it, and should know about if we're going to have informed consent of the governed, because otherwise you have consent of the governed, but the governed are clueless about what's being done by their government and their names with their tax dollars. And so it's not informed consent, so therefore it's not really consent at all. There's a word for that, which is dictatorship. I don't need to go that far rhetorically, but it's not democracy to have consent when you don't know what you're consenting to and what's being done is behind closed doors, behind the curtain. A lot of what we've been hearing is in the media, and it does sort of go with that paradox view that you described, Peter, that some people feel, well, you know, it's good he did it, there's real positives, but he should be punished. It's the idea that, well, Bradley Manning, he should face the consequences. And at first glance, that sounds logical. But a big problem is that we need whistleblowers like Bradley Manning and Edward Snowden, because they're exposing what has been done by top leaders of the government who never face the consequences of what they do. And so we have this fundamental contradiction between the rhetoric of facing consequences and the reality that you have people like Bush and Cheney, and dare I say it, Biden and Obama, who don't face the consequences of their action. They escalate and triple the troop levels in Afghanistan. They're warned not to do it. As Bradley Manning showed, they covered up some of the terrible slaughter of civilians that resulted. And then you've got Obama and Biden and so forth, just like Cheney and Bush in this sense, and they don't face any consequences at all. We've had this spying on us, our emails, our texts, our phone calls by the NSA. They are violating our civil liberties. They are violating the Constitution. They don't have to face any consequences at all. So, you know, when you've got presidents and senators and commanding generals who face the consequences and are punished for their violations of human rights, then people should come back and talk about how Bradley Manning, a PFC in the Army, should face the consequences. But until then, what we have is rampant hypocrisy masquerading as government virtue.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things, and I'm sure you would agree with this, Norman Solomon, is that when you have a worldwide empire involved in constant wars with plans for invasions and occupations of any number of countries as contingency plans, these laws go with the territory.
Yes. Well, constant is the adjective here, constant wars. Because when you have de facto a kind of a warfare state, and, you know, after a dozen years of war with no end in sight, you gotta think we do have sort of perpetual warfare, then secrecy and surveillance does come with the territory. That's what we're living under now. That's where there's all this tap dancing going on Capitol Hill and certainly out of the White House with NSA surveillance, where there's all kinds of efforts to speak around, talk around, and excuse what is inexcusable. And that is, you know, the most, I was at a demonstration I helped to organize here just north of the Golden Gate Bridge in California against the minority leader of the U.S. House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, who staunchly has been defending the NSA surveillance program. And we were just confronting the reality that there is a defense of violating our Bill of Rights, particularly having to do with privacy and freedom of the press. And the most radical statement that we could make and did make at that rally, if you will, is to read the Fourth Amendment out loud. The Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution, one of the key pillars of the Bill of Rights. And it simply says, you know, in layman's terms, in laywomen's terms, the government doesn't have a right to go into your home, rifle your stuff, and take whatever it wants and search through your private life without warranted reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't just do a generalized warrant and say, we're going to search 100 million people's phone records or 100 million people's emails, which is what the U.S. government is doing. They need a very specific warrant, and that's spelled out in the United States Constitution's Fourth Amendment. And it's stunning to me. It's sort of like, you know, Woody Guthrie said, any damn fool can be complicated. We've got to be very clear and simple. You read the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, it's clear that this government is violating it every day.
Well, careful, though, Norman Solomon. The Constitution is no protection. I'm sure you know in the period of the Espionage Act, 1970, when the U.S. was just about to enter the war or already had entered it, there was a man prosecuted for passing out copies of the Bill of Rights. This was under the Woodrow Wilson administration, whose administration about civil liberties made that of George Bush and Dick Cheney look like ACLU members. But that's maybe a conversation for another time. Norman Solomon's my guest, and he is the co-founder of RootsAction.org. We're talking about the Bradley Manning case, as we did maybe 6-8 weeks ago, when right before the trial began. And Roots Action has a petition in progress for saying that the Nobel Peace Prize ought to go to Bradley Manning. How's it going? You have over 100,000 signers so far?
Yes, we've just gone over the 100,000 mark, and it's really exciting, and I do want to invite all your listeners, Peter, to go to the website. It's rootsaction.org, and take you about 1 minute to add your name, and if you'd like, your hometown and your comments to the petition for a Nobel Peace Prize for Bradley Manning. Very soon now, in the middle of August, I'm to be carrying a petition with those 100,000 names and hometowns and comments into the front door of the Norwegian Nobel Committee in Oslo. And it's going to be, you know, a heavy lift, but I'm going to carry this probably 5,000 pages through the door. And I do have an appointment there that's being set up for the exact time, but I have a green light from the committee that they will, as they said, receive me and the petition. And I'm going to ask that the committee read the comments. And you know, at one level, it's a lot to ask because 1 out of 5 of the signers has written a personal individual comment about Bradley Manning and why that individual has signed the petition, how they feel about Bradley Manning and the issues involved. Well, that's 20,000 comments. So I recognize that's, you know, asking something, but there's really a groundswell of, I think, well-justified, passionate embrace of Bradley Manning because he embodies the best of human conscience, which every day in our workaday lives and sometimes if we're in a situation that gives us historic opportunity, whether it's a small issue or a large one, we have a choice to make. Do we go with the powerful? Do we go with the turning our eyes away from injustice? Or do we speak up and really try to make a difference?
Now, Bradley Manning receiving the Nobel Peace Prize is not an outlier effort. He's actually been nominated pretty formally by a former Nobel Peace Laureate. Can you tell us some about that?
That's right. Mairead Corrigan McGuire won the Nobel Peace Prize for her work in Northern Ireland for peace. And she wrote an article in the Guardian newspaper in Britain a couple of weeks ago explaining why this year she has nominated Bradley Manning to win the same prize that she did. And under the rules of the Nobel Committee, one of the groups of people who can formally nominate for a future Nobel Peace Prize is the winner of a past one. And she really spells out, as she puts it, she can't think of anybody else who's more deserving on the entire planet. She recognizes and talks about how by exposing, for instance, the massacre that I mentioned, documented by the U.S. Diplomatic cable that he released, Bradley Manning really helped to end the Iraq War, because when that information was made public, there was such an uproar in Iraq that it forced the Iraqi government to say to Washington, look, we want jurisdiction to be able to, in Iraqi courts, prosecute any criminal conduct by the U.S. military in our country. And that was a no-go zone for officials in Washington. They don't want to subject, when they're occupying a country, they don't want their troops to be subject to any authority of the government of that country, because after all, it's an occupation effort. It's a way of the U.S. trying to dominate that country. So when the gauntlet got thrown down, thanks to Bradley Manning, it hastened the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. And I think that's very stunning.
Sure.
You know, how is it that one Army private, through an act of conscience, was able to help end a war?
The late historian Howard Zinn said something, I hope I'm quoting him correctly, he said, I don't know whether he said the left or the progressive forces or whatever, lose every battle but eventually win every war, in the way that we've been able to expand the rights guaranteed under our foundation documents in this country. So I've been involved in so many hopeless efforts. Is there actually any chance that the Nobel Prize could go to him? I mean, that would be such a stick in the eye of the United States. It seems like they wouldn't dare, or would they?
Well, it would be a surprise. As the saying goes, we might guess that the chances are between slim and none, but I don't think they're none.
Yeah.
I do think they're slim, but it's not impossible. And the fact is that a lot of people in a lot of countries, and you'll read it in the comments on this petition, which, again, people can find at rootsaction.org for a Nobel Peace Prize for Manning, you will read again and again a sentiment that I think is pretty widespread, including in this country. Why in blazes did the Nobel Committee give the Nobel Peace Prize to President Barack Obama in his first year, as he was escalating by tripling the troop levels in Afghanistan, the war in that country?
Let me do this, though. We're almost out of time, and I wanted to get one real quick answer in from you. I mentioned earlier about the Bush administration and its role in the suppression of civil liberties. And so I assume that under the Bush administration that this kind of prosecutions of leakers and all was much worse.
Well, you would guess that, and you would be wrong, because despite the terrible policies of the Bush administration, it didn't hold a candle to prosecution of whistleblowers compared to the Obama administration, which has been prosecuting now 7 different whistleblowers, more than all the other presidencies in the history of this country combined.
Wow. Well, we're almost out of time, but we do have just a few seconds left, and I wish you could just reiterate about, because some people join us at different periods, about the petition. There's a petition to the Nobel Committee in Oslo. It has more than 100,000 signers on it, and the group that Norman Solomon helped co-found, RootsAction.org, is going to present these to the Nobel Peace Committee, Peace Prize Committee, to say that it should go to Bradley Manning. It's an easy. You just go to RootsAction.org, and you're there. No salesman will call or anything like that.
That's right, and people can simply add their names and any comments you'd like, and literally I will carry, therefore, your name and your comments into the front door of the Nobel Committee in Oslo, Norway, and I'll be very proud to do that.
Well, I said at the beginning that you, Norman Solomon, have probably been a guest on my show more than any other single person, and maybe you do this because now we got to have another follow-up, don't we? But you know that I love to interview you, and I know that whenever I tell my producer Jalene Jordan that I'm going to interview you, she always says, "Norman."
Well, please give her my best, and it's always a pleasure to talk with you on the air and off, Peter. Keep up the great work.
All right, and you can go, again, to rootsaction.org and also normansolomon.com. You see all of the other things that Norman's into. All of this will have a link at Peter Werbe, PeterWerbe.com. Norman, as usual, thanks for joining me.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. I'm looking at a copy of the Declaration of Independence. You all know what that is, I hope, right? And in the second paragraph, it says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." And those are words that they talk about the shot heard around the world. In many ways, that was words heard around the world. This was not a concept previously held, that all men are created equal, that we were no longer subjects but became citizens with inalienable rights, as it also says in the Declaration of Independence. But I think most of us have learned now that we want a gender-neutral word. If we would have been writing this today, we would have said all people are created equal. But the idea that women also had equal rights within the countries in which they live throughout the world has only really taken force, although there's been all sorts of things previously, but in with real strength in the last 50 or 60 years. And you could call it, in a way, an unfinished revolution. In fact, that's the book I have in front of me called The Unfinished Revolution, Voices from the Global Fight for Women's Rights. And it's edited by Minky Warden. And Minky Warden is the director of Global Initiatives for Human Rights Watch. And she develops and implements international outreach and advocacy campaigns. She had an incredible history of working around the world. She speaks Cantonese and German. She's a member of the Overseas Press Club's Board of Governors. She's the co-editor of a book called Torture from the New Press, and editor of China's Great Leap from Seven Stories Press. And the latest book she's edited, The Unfinished Revolution, is also from Seven Stories Press. We welcome Minky Warden from her office in New York City. Welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks for having me.
How's my history? I mean, in terms of, would you, is that good to say the modern women's revolution is only like half a century old?
Yeah, I think it's, I think we're at this incredibly important moment. You know, here in the United States, I think we take a lot of the rights and freedoms that we enjoy today for granted. In much of the world, the prospects for education, for opportunity, the struggle to secure basic rights, including health, the right to marry whom you want, these are rights that aren't yet secured. And you know, the world has just seen the Arab Spring uprisings in Egypt, Tunisia, in Libya, and uprisings that are continuing in other parts of the world, such as Syria. One of the messages of this book, and it's also a play on the revolution, because those were revolutionary political uprisings. One of the core messages of the book is that the struggle to secure basic rights and freedoms for women and girls is not complete, and in many parts of the world, it's going to be an uphill battle.
In your book, The Unfinished Revolution, as we said, the subtitle, Voices from the Global Fight for Women's Rights, the idea that they've been secured here, like, no one thinks it's particularly peculiar that I'm editing a woman. Yet 50 years ago, there wouldn't have been any woman newscasters, probably no senators, and on and on. Women have become part of the social, political, and cultural fabric in a manner that anybody, I'm sure, under 40 absolutely takes for granted. So here in the United States, is that part of the global fight for women's rights?
Yeah, yes, it is. And, you know, I'm 45 years old, and I think, you know, I tend to take, you know, like everyone else, these rights for granted. I work at an organization, Human Rights Watch, that has more than 60% of our researchers, our lawyers, the people who cover conflicts for us, they're women. And I think that, but it's, you know, in a way, it is, it gives us a comfort area. We don't often look, we're not looking for the abuses as they're occurring. And one of the, for example, one of the most compelling chapters in the book is by a writer named Sarah Tofte, who is, as a Human Rights Watch researcher, uncovered this amazing phenomenon that many tens of thousands of girls and women who had been raped, they go through a procedure to collect a rape kit and put, you know, through the police department. And those, you know, the assumption is that after you suffered sexual violence, after you've gone through the indignity of collecting medical specimens, DNA for testing, you know, we've all seen CSI, you just assume that that's going to be tested. What Sarah uncovered is that due to bureaucratic inertia, lack of budget in Chicago, in Los Angeles, in other cities around the United States, there were, you know, Indiana Jones-like warehouses full of untested rape kits. Now, what that meant is that the women who have were victims of sexual violence will never see justice. It also means, you know, for a society as a whole, that there are rapists who have committed multiple rapes going around who have are not being brought to justice. So I think, you know, that's a single example of how the U.S. criminal justice system, politicians, and the police are failing women and girls who are victims of one of the worst crimes that can occur. We also look at the problem for out-of-status women, migrants in the United States, and how vulnerable they are to human rights abuses around the United States. So I think the book focuses on the world, and we really attempt to look at both at regions and countries such as Congo or Afghanistan or China where human rights abuses occur, but we look at the United States because of the perception that the United States is a leader in protecting rights for women, and where we're not, that sets a bad example for the rest of the world.
Thank you, Warden. In the book you edited, The Unfinished Revolution, Voices from the Global Fight for Women's Rights, you told me before we got on the air that that you could find a lot of the chapters fairly depressing, so that there is continual assaults and even cultural practices that most people, certainly all women everywhere, I would think, or at least I would hope so, and great numbers of men would find absolutely abhorrent. So women aren't faring quite as well, and that's kind of an ironic use of that, in other parts of the world.
You know, the intent is not to depress, but rather to galvanize. And, you know, the book has several different themes and messages. I think you have to document what is occurring and understand it before you can be moved to action, before you can, really understand the sophisticated approach that's needed to address women's rights in the world today. And I'll give one example. You know, there's a lot of discussion in the United States, for example, about the military pullout from Afghanistan. And Afghanistan is one of the countries where measurable gains have been made for women and girls over the last decade. And we obviously want to preserve those gains and even advance them. One of the chapters in the book, which is called Letters in the Night, looks at how the Taliban is regaining ground, the phenomenon of what are called night letters. Taliban or other fundamentalists will send to women teachers or women who are working outside the home, send to to girls who are attending school letters that are really death threats. They're slipped under the door, left on the door at night, and they say things like, we will kill you in such a harsh way that no woman has been killed in this manner. This will be a good lesson for those women like you who are working. And that type of, you know, I think we need to understand that the risks that some women take to take part in public life in a country like Afghanistan or Iraq, and we need to find ways to support them so that they're able to enjoy some of the rights and freedoms that we are accustomed to in the United States.
I think women probably are going to be quite at risk again. I mean, the United, I can't imagine, I hope this doesn't act as a rationale for remaining in Afghanistan, because certainly women are suffering under the United States occupation as well. I mean, the attempt to suppress the Taliban, these fundamentalist right-wingers, is you would hope they would just go away. I mean, actually, women did best during the period of the Soviet domination and the communist government of Afghanistan. I mean, they were committed to gender equality. I don't know how big it ever got into the hinterlands, but at least officially, it was. And women did take part considerably in the... But, you know, it all seems like evil choices. The Soviet Union, bad. United States occupation, bad. The Taliban, bad. Where does that leave Afghan women? Not a very pretty place.
Well, I think, you know, the answer is like all of the answers in the book. And that is, and I think it's important to understand that there are answers. They're difficult and they're complex problems. But if you tackle them in, you know, ways that we know have worked in other places, and I'll give this example. You know, right now the political actor with the single most influence over President Karzai in Afghanistan is the United States. Karzai has lots of things that he wants from the United States, and one of the benchmarks for the departure of U.S. forces should be that there are put in place protections for women in the Constitution, in laws, but that's not enough. There also have to be protection mechanisms that are set up. Human Rights Watch put out a new report just in the last week looking at women and girls who have fled their attackers and who have been jailed for that. So there are as many as 400 women and girls who are in jails all over Afghanistan who are being punished for essentially fleeing violence and fleeing their attackers. And that's the type of thing where the U.S. could weigh in and have a positive effect in changing laws that make life very difficult for mm-hmm. women and girls in Afghanistan. And it's the other key thing is to understand that in many places, women are agents of change themselves. They are risking their lives to stand for parliament. They are women lawyers are working to revise constitutions. Women are in places like Libya, Egypt, Tunisia. Women bloggers and citizen journalists are out on the streets documenting human rights abuses. So I think the book is really intended to give a very clear picture of a series of human rights abuses that are occurring around the world today, but also to spotlight women who are changing things themselves. And one of the core messages, we look in the book at something called harmful traditional practices. And some of these, an example of a harmful traditional practice is foot binding. So foot binding was the practice for centuries in China, and yet within a century, it was eliminated.
Women. Yeah.
Entirely. Yeah. Binding feet of women, which essentially crippled them.
They would have these small little feet that these people, men would find sexually appealing, called them like the little lotus, although.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Precisely, and it was really something that was done for the pleasure of men. It had the practical effect of crippling many hundreds of thousands of women, but it was a practice that, with education, government intervention, and getting the really getting the message out to families, it was eradicated within a generation. I'll give a couple of examples of harmful traditional practices in the world today.
Well, let me do this. Let me reintroduce you in the book, because we have people joining us frequently throughout the broadcast. I'm talking with Minky Warden. She's edited the book, The Unfinished Revolution, Voices from the Global Fight for Women's Rights. This is the Peter Werbe Show. The foreword to the book is by Christiane Amanpour, and you can go to the website, HRW, that's humanrightswatch.org. Very good site to go to frequently. But for the book, it's hrw.org/unfinished-revolution, or dash, I guess it is. My website will have a link as well, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. And just we think about foot-binding, men finding that attractive. You wonder, what guy somewhere in history said, oh, I got a good idea? But let me pose a question to you, and I want to hear that your other examples as well that you started. Do you feel comfortable saying that all fundamentalist religions are the enemy of women, whether it's Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Hinduism? They all seem to not be in step with what you call in your book, The Unfinished Revolution.
But not at all. I think, in a sense, some of the debates over, say, the role of fundamentalist Islam or Christianity divert you from the real issues. And we have, for example, a terrific chapter on the question of religious dress. So that's the veiling of women. And it's a huge debate, for example. In Europe, Turkey has had bans on the wearing of headscarves in schools. And where Human Rights Watch comes down on this is that no religion and no government should be dictating what it is that women wear. So governments such as the government in Chechnya attack women who are not wearing headscarves, who are not wearing veils. But it's equally wrong to force women who prefer to wear a headscarf out of a headscarf. So it's one of these, the question of the role of religion. I'll take another example from our harmful traditional practices discussion. A harmful traditional practice is a practice that has a veneer of religious approval, for example, often. There's a terrific chapter on what is called female genital mutilation. And just to put this in a very straightforward way, this is the cutting of often very young girls, genital cutting. It's a practice that affects, according to the United Nations, between 100 million and 140 million girls around the world today.
Tell people why they do it, though. I mean, this has got a cultural and religious reason to it. It's horrible.
It has a cultural and religious reason. It's a traditional practice it's rooted in local culture, but it is there are a variety of reasons. One is the perception that it keeps women and girls virtuous. Another one is the wrong perception that it is required by Sharia law. Human Rights Watch did a report in Iraqi Kurdistan looking at this practice, and what we found is that there is a religious veneer. So if you're going to tackle this practice, if you're going to end the cutting of girls in the world today, our prescription for it is this. One, you have to document the practice. Two, you have to get a law passed by the local parliament or government that makes it illegal. But it's also midwives, it's family members who cut these girls. So you have to have an education campaign that this practice is a creates tremendous health problems for girls down the line. They later die in childbirth. They have all sorts of health and psychological implications to this. You also have to, but it's somebody's job to do the cuttings. You have to create economic opportunities for the midwives or the family members who are doing the cutting. And then finally, we succeeded to get a fatwa issued by the local religious authority that said that it is not required under Sharia law to cut your girls. And so it's a, in most cases, tackling a harmful traditional practice, which, I mean, let's make no mistake, this is a terrible, terrible practice affecting millions of women around the world today. It, in order to end it, it is insufficient to just pass a law. It's insufficient to have a campaign condemning it. You have to work with the local authorities on the ground. It requires education, and where there is a religious approval of a human rights abuse of women, you actually, to be most effective, you're going to need to find some clerics to say, you know, this is a practice that's against the Quran.
Yeah, the book, The Unfinished Revolution, Minky Warden, that you edited also has some wonderful photos. Some of them are very stirring. In fact, probably the most stirring one, at least to me, is that goes around the front and the back cover that shows women in, where is this, in Egypt?
This is in Iraq.
Oh, this is in Iraq, huh?
This is in Iraq. This is, you know, one of the, we have a chapter on women in Iraq, and this is a demonstration, that has both, as you can see, both women and men, and this is an Arab Spring, demonstration, and it's a, I think, you know, the tendency is to think, a lot of people, did not, you know, the one common element across the Arab Spring political transitions was that there were women in the front lines. And the reason, this is a photo that was shot by one of the contributors to the book, Samer Muscati, who grew up in Iraq. And one of the common element that women were in the front lines of these political revolutions, but that now that the constitutions are being written, now that the parliaments are being selected, now that the cabinets are being selected, women are finding themselves sidelined. When they attend demonstrations these days, they're mocked, they're sexually abused. So it's, I think that that's a very negative trend, and it's something that we have to fight against.
Yeah, the women being shown too do have headscarves on, but their joy that they show, they're holding, depending on how you read it, a peace sign or a victory sign, and the joy that they're expressing is palpable. And I could imagine, not only because of the issue directly that they're addressing, but also because they're participating as full human beings. Or am I reading too much into it?
No, I think that's very much the message. You know, on the one hand, that this is a time of great change, particularly in the Arab world, but with potentially global implications. You also have, it's also a time of great risk and of great fragility for women's rights. And I think one of the chapters that captures both the hope and the risk is the chapter looking at Egypt by Esra Abdel Fattah, one of her nicknames is Facebook Girl. She was one of the early organizers of social media campaigns in Egypt, and really used those tools not only to give herself a voice, but to give all of the Egyptian people a voice. And so you see I interviewed a number of women and men, people from all the whole political spectrum in Egypt, artists, writers, activists, actors, and the common message is that this is a moment of great hope, and a feeling that this is a time when things can change, but if we fail to press for example, constitutions that protect rights. I mean, it's a moment when constitutions could easily be put in place that roll back rights for women, And, you know, the Middle East is a part of the world where women were, for example, there's something called personal status laws, where women are treated as a matter of law as half of a man. You don't have rights to divorce, and no matter how abusive your husband is. In Saudi Arabia, for example, women are treated as effectively as children. You need your husband's permission to leave the country. You cannot drive yourself to the supermarket. You cannot participate in sports. Boys in school may take physical education. Girls cannot participate in sports in any way.
Let me interrupt you because we have about 60 seconds left. Is there hope? I mean, this seems so rooted, and you talk about 150 million women, you know, suffering genital mutilation. Which way is the glass? Is it hopefully half full and we're going up? But I need about 60 seconds. I know this is a big question.
Well, I think that, you know, the critical thing is that this is a moment of great change. You have to understand what is happening in the world today, but even for the most entrenched human rights abuses against women, and they often center around violence against women in some way, even for the most entrenched abuses, it is possible to change those practices. It requires you changing laws, changing minds, changing societies, but really now is the time to do that.
Well, I want to thank you so much. My guest has been Minky Warden, and she's edited the book, The Unfinished Revolution, Voices from the Global Fight for Women's Rights, and it's published by Seven Stories Press. You can go to hrw.org, that's Human Rights Watch, where Minky Warden is the Director of Global Initiatives for Human Rights. But if you go to hrw.org/unfinished-revolution, you'll get directly to the book. There'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Minky Warden, thanks so much for being on the broadcast.
Thanks for a terrific discussion.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Mike Rowe here. So I'm at a Ford dealer talking with customers about how taking care of your car is kind of like taking care of yourself. And I ask, which is in better shape, you or your car? Hint, the answer has four wheels.
Get the works. An oil change, tire rotation, and more for $39.95 or less minus a $10 mail-in rebate. That's $29.95. Click on the banner ad now. Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, and disposal fees extra. Rebate by check. See participating Ford dealer for exclusions and rebate details through 8/31/13.
Now's the time.
Now's the time to make a difference.
Now's the time to do what's right.
To help a family.
Now's the time to volunteer.
To make a commitment.
To make new friends.
To make dreams come true.
To help a child.
Now's the time to help Habitat for Humanity build hope and change lives with a family in your community or around the world.
Now's the time.
Now, more than ever, help build it.
Visit Habitat.org.
101 WRIF.
Welcome to
Everything That Rocks.
Oh, my God.
Get all of Dave and Chuck the Freak's best moments delivered right to your computer or mobile device. Brought to you by the Specs Howard School of Media Arts. Subscribe today at WRIF.com.
I could not foresee this thing happening to you.